ち闇の国に隠されし一人の王族がいた。森の深ささえ知らず、幾年も小さな城で生きた。ある朝旅立ちの時、ただ前だけを見て。
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
This week on the show, we're here to talk about... You know what, Sean? I didn't write my intro this week. Sometimes I write my intro out. Sometimes I don't. Usually if I mess it up like that, we just stop. But no, we are letting people see how the sausage is made today.
Okay, all right, yeah. I mean, you know, people listening to this podcast probably just assume, Jonathan, that you nail the intro 100% of the time. As the co-host of the podcast, I know that is not at all true. And I'm excited that now you're comfortable enough to be able to just say, now you fuck this one up.
Sean, this is episode 280. You know,
yes, it is.
If you're in for a penny with this show, you're in for a pound. I think that's what it's about. No, guys, this week on the show is kind of a grab bag week. I have been playing the new Nintendo game, Yoshi's Crafted World. I'm going to talk about that. Sean, you've been playing the exact polar opposite of that game, Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice. So you're going to talk more about that. You gave us, like, very brief thoughts last time, but we've both put some time into these games, so we can talk about those. We're going to talk about the news. We've got reports out about the potential new designs of the Nintendo Switch. Some interesting video games were announced. A beloved filmmaker, Agnes Varda, passed away, and I want to talk about her for at least a little while. And we've also just got some fun stuff. This is just going to kind of be a hangout episode. We were thinking about doing the next Lord of the Rings film in our rewatch this week, but just neither of us really had the time or energy to put into that because, you know, we want to be on the top of our game for those films.
Yeah, and it was a situation where I realized I could have watched the movie and done that for the podcast, or I could have had a much better outline for, like, my lessons for next week. It was, like, the priorities of, like, it probably would be a better idea to have my shit together before the end of spring break than watch a three-hour movie.
That's fair. And the Two Towers Extended is 3 hours and 45 minutes, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. So three-hour movie is technically rounding too far down.
it's a significant time commitment. They are good movies, but they are very long.
Which, you know, is part of what makes them great. I mean, have you heard... So this is not a news thing. Just I'm doing this just out the top because it makes me... I'm kind of interested in this. That Avengers Endgame is going to be 3 hours long.
Yes, yeah. I saw that runtime making its rounds around Twitter. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I know a lot of people are bitching about it, being like, oh, that's so long. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'm glad someone had the balls to put out a three-hour movie again. You know what? Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say it. Because I feel like if any major, like, blockbuster right now has earned the three-hour time length, it feels like the 22nd Marvel movie that's, like, wrapping up the plots of all of them and is probably going to be the swan song for Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans and a lot of the leads, that feels like a justified use of 3 hours. I'm glad they're doing it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I'm with you. Like, a three-hour movie is not an automatic turnoff to me. It's like a movie needs to earn those 3 hours. And based on how good Infinity War was and the amount of material that Endgame seems like it needs to have, I agree. 3 hours seems totally reasonable.
I mean, I want Endgame to have a Return of the King-style ending, right? You know, I want it to give us a coda to these characters. It would be sad if it felt truncated. So, anyway, that's neither here nor there, but I just thought I'd bring it up. One other thing I want to bring up before we jump into the news and the stuff, Sean, is that, as I said earlier, this is episode 280 of the podcast, which, for those of you keeping score at home, means we are 20 episodes away from episode 300. That's a lot of podcasts, Sean.
I feel like I said this at episode 100, but it's still true. That's too many. We've done too many.
Too many podcasts. For podcast 100, for podcast 200, for podcast 250 even... We've done different kind of special episodes. We usually do a fun list or something like that. And Sean, you and I have done a little bit of chat about this, but we're still not sure what we want to do for 300. So I thought you and I could just swap some ideas here real quick, see if listeners, if you want to tweet at us or email us, you know, go to the website, weeklystuffpodcast.com. All the contact stuff is there. And tell us any other ideas you have. Maybe we can even put this up to a vote at some point. But, you know, we are a couple months away. Episode 300 will be in late August or early September. And, you know, I feel like we should start thinking about it, Sean.
Yeah, no, it's a thing. 300 episodes.
It is. So I had two ideas. One is just one we've always wanted to do, never gotten around to, is favorite video game soundtracks. I'm kind of surprised we've never done a formal episode about that.
Yeah, because we definitely talk about video game music a lot, because we listen to a lot of video game music. And video game music has been really fucking good for a while now.
Yes, and I think that would be a very fun one. We also joked a couple weeks ago, but then you and I started thinking about it, and we're like, that actually could be kind of fun, about doing favorite books. And, you know, we would have to, like, figure out what the constraints on that are. Like, is it fiction? Is it, like, is it just anything that is printed as a book? You know, we could talk about that. But a possible favorite books list is also something we have never done. I don't know if people would be interested in that, but I think it would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just when the idea came up as a joke in front of the Fellowship podcast, because I think it was because you said those were one of your favorite books.
Yeah.
It seemed silly to me at first, and then the idea of, like, why, like, I could just spend 30 minutes on the podcast talking about the Canterbury Tales. Why the fuck not? Like, why not? Why the fuck not do that?
Sean, you have collectively spent at least 30 minutes on this podcast talking about the Canterbury Tales.
Yeah, but it's always been in little bits and spurts around the edges, not like, here, let's, like, do a close read of the first 15 lines of the general prologue or some bullshit.
See, this would be fun because when we do, like, favorite movies, that's, like, my educational domain. That's what I teach and have degrees in, and I kind of nerd out over. This is your domain, Sean, and I want to hear you nerd out over the Canterbury Tales or whatever your equivalent of The Double Life of Veronique is to me.
Yeah, exactly. So whether or not that will be episode 300, that is definitely an episode we should do at some point.
Yes. My only actually reservation for doing that at 300 is I might need more time to prepare for it. Because I would want to reread things, and rereading things takes more time than rewatching things. Or just, you know, gazing over a video, like jumping into a video game and remembering what it was like. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it could be for 300. You know, I've always wanted to do an episode, it doesn't have to be 300, on favorite movie scores as well, when we're talking about soundtracks. That could be one at some point. I don't know. It doesn't have to be a list either. Do you have any 300 ideas?
The one that immediately comes to mind for me is, because we did one forever, I don't even know if it was a Weekly Stuff episode or not, but TV shows, top 10 favorite TV shows.
We did at some point, yes.
Yeah, we did a long, and I know for sure my list would be like probably 80% different.
Mine would be too.
Yeah.
And frankly, the only thing that gives me pause about that, and it is a great idea, is that TV is such an absurdly broad category at this point. Mm. I don't know what I would, you know what I mean? Like,
sure,
TV
yeah.
is so many things. You're right. It would be very different for me. I think it would absolutely be fun. So I would put it on the list, yes. And I think, yeah, that gives us a couple of good options. And again, I want to do all of these as episodes. We've just got to figure out what they should be. But TV shows would make sense because we redid our movies list. We redid our video games list. Probably time to redo our TV shows list.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then my other idea, which is dumb because the TV show list would kind of do this anyways for me, would be top 10 anime, which was a thing that came up on Twitter, and it would be more a way to finally get you to watch more anime.
It would
be.
You
haven't watched enough anime.
The way I watch anime is in depth, not in breadth. I know some anime very, very well, but I don't know a lot of anime, so yes, I like, you know, I have my fucking Dragon Ball shelf. But I do not have not seen, like, Mobile Suit Gundam, you know, things like that.
Yeah, but the nice thing about stuff like Mobile Suit Gundam is instead of being 300 episodes, it's 43
exactly.
episodes.
Exactly, yes.
Just, like, you just watch that stuff.
I want Top 10 Anime to be one we do at some point in the future. It might be too soon for it to be 300, you know. What we might want to do is separate and say for TV shows, anime is something else. TV shows is just not going to be anime, and we'll leave anime for kind of a North Star future episode, or not. Depends on how you want to do it.
That would be interesting, yeah, because that would be the difficulty for me with TV shows, is how much of it is anime, how much of it is not, and how does anything compete with anime in a realistic sense?
Yes.
That's a real question that you know, is tears me apart sometimes.
Speaking of that question, Sean. Well, actually, okay, you know what? Yeah. I'll get into this transition in a second. So anyway, those are our ideas for now. I'm going to ask about them again on Twitter. You guys tell us if you have any ideas. We'll finalize this list next week or in a week or two, and we'll put a poll out and see what the feeling of the people is. That poll will be non-binding because it does depend on like what we can get ready for that time. Luckily, we've got the summer before Podcast 300 because we like to put some work into these. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway... those are all good ideas. But here, getting into stuff, Sean, this is not on the outline, but I forgot to put it on there. I gave kind of a lecture this week on anime in school.
Yes, I saw you put that on Twitter. You had a nice Dragon Ball slide.
It seemed good. So I TA a class, it's Intro to Film Studies, and we were doing our week on Japanese cinema. And we watched Rashomon by Akira Kurosawa. And he talked about post-war Japanese cinema, which is one of my areas of expertise. But I thought, you know, the lectures this week by the professor, they covered that pretty well. The thing he didn't talk about was anime. And so I thought we do these discussion sections. Other schools sometimes call them breakouts or recitations. It's where big lectures split into like 20-person groups, and a TA teaches those, and they're like an hour long. So I thought, I'll put together a lesson on anime. And the immediate thing when I sat down to do that was like, that's a big category. So, you know, I tried to focus it because my main assertion I wanted to make, Sean, is that why do we talk about anime? For me, it's that it is the single most visible international cinema in America, like by leaps and bounds. And I could prove this scientifically very easily with my students where I said, who has seen Japanese animation? And everybody raises their hands, right? Because even if you don't like it, you've seen it. And then I say, who has sat down and watched a Polish film? And across my three classes, one student raised their hand, and that student happens to be Polish. So, and I'm not picking on Poland. Poland has great cinema. I hope no one was thinking that. Now that it comes to mind, I'm hoping no one thought I was being prejudiced. But it's just not a cinema that has visibility, right?
Yeah.
If it's France, Germany, like all, you know, most major European countries, people over here probably have actually not seen anything from. But you've seen anime. So it's worth talking about. And I shared stories about the early 2000s anime boom when we were kids, you know. I actually, Sean, I found when I was moving last year, I was helping my mom move, and then I moved here going through all my stuff. I found all my Pokemon cards from when I was a kid.
Nice.
They're in a giant binder next to me. There's got to be stuff that's worth something in here, because Pokemon cards I was looking online go for a lot online now. But I found the promotional card they gave out with Pokemon 2000. And I showed that to my students, because I showed them the teaser for Pokemon 2000. And it says at the end, get your cool card if you come to the theater. And I'm like, and I have it. You know, just trying to show them that, like, you know, now anime comes to theaters. It's there for a day or two. The Pokemon movies were just movies, right?
Yeah.
The first one made $100 million. So I talked about that. I talked about how we're in a return of the anime boom because of streaming and how that has changed the business model, and talked about Crunchyroll and Netflix's big push for anime. I actually used the example we talked about last week about Evangelion having a countdown to the countdown of the release date, you know, of like, this is how big it is right now. I did some history. I talked to them about Isao Takahata's first film, Horus, Prince of the Sun, which is one of the... you know, roots of all modern anime. Did a little bit on Miyazaki, because he's the guy everyone knows. And then I had some other examples. I made a slide about Persona, and I was using Persona as an example of horizontal integration in the anime industry, of how I just showed, I'm like, okay, so here's Persona 3 the game, here's Persona 3 Fest, here's Persona 3 Portable, here's the Persona 3 dancing game, here's the 30 different albums, here's the stage show they did, here's the concert they did, and here's the movies they did, and I was going to show a clip from the movie. I did not have a time to get through all of that, but I thought it was a good example, and also I was able to mention the name Persona in class. And then I closed with... I talked about Dragon Ball a little bit, because I showed them pictures of, like, my collections, and, like this is what I love, right? And the clip... Sean, do you want to guess what clip I showed them from Dragon Ball, just knowing me and my stupid tastes?
I mean, that's a big ask, Jonathan.
I did it to produce a laugh.
All of Dragon Ball.
Yes.
To produce a laugh. I mean, my immediate go-to would just be from, like, the beginning of Goku meeting Bulma. That's probably the thing that pops to mind for me immediately. I don't know for you.
I showed them the clip from DBZ Movie 1 where Gohan gets drunk on the apple and sings.
Ugh. Yeah, that's one.
Yep.
Yep, you could do that. You could do Oolong Wishing for Panties if you just want to go full bore, lean all the way into it.
Yep. No, I did it mostly because I said, you know, there's that Tim Burton Dumbo movie came out in theaters this weekend that no one saw. Mm-hmm. And I said, so you guys know, you've seen the animated Dumbo, right? And they're all like, yeah. And I'm like, do you remember the pink elephant sequence? And they're like, yeah, that was fucking weird. And I'm like, here's the Japanese equivalent of that. And it was fun. So people were very weirded out by it.
You could have shown the clip of Gotenks fighting Hitler. That would be another good one.
I thought about it because I have like the nice Blu-rays, you know?
Uh-huh.
I wound up having to use one of the old DVDs because I thought, I probably shouldn't show them 3 minutes of unsubtitled anime singing.
That would probably be a bit much.
I had to go back to my... I have several copies of that movie. I had to go back to my oldest copy of Dead Zone because the Funimation version does not have subtitles on the singing for some reason. But the old Pioneer release has it. And that's the one that I've showed you this, Sean, is so old. The packaging is a cardboard box with a CD jewel case inside. And I showed that to my students also. And they're like, how the fuck old is this? And I'm like, older than you are, kids. Older than you are.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I had fun doing that this week. What have you been up to?
I played so much Sekiro. So much Sekiro that as of 2 hours ago, I am a proud victor of the game of Sekiro Shadows Die Twice.
Oh, wow.
I finished that game. Took me basically this entire week. I basically spent all my spring break grading essays, playing Sekiro, and watching Mobile Suit Gundam Double Zeta. It was with the exception of having to grade a bunch of essays, it was a very good spring break.
That sounds good, yeah. I did not have any, like, new cool games come out on my spring break, so I mostly just did work.
That's unfortunate.
No, that's okay. But yeah, so you're going to talk about Sekiro later as
yes,
one of our
we'll
main
do that
topics.
As our main topic, yeah.
Because one of the games I played this week is much older than Sekiro, I'm going to talk about it here for a second, Sean. Because
right.
The game I played this week is... I was waiting for Yoshi to come out, and I, you know, no, here's the story of how this happened, is Monday night, so almost a full week ago, Monday night, it was, I got home from, god damn it, my French New Wave cinema class, he showed us 200-minute movies in a row for our screening. Our screening is supposed to go from 7:30 to 10, it went longer than that. Because it was two, you know, 90-minute... one of them was like 90, one of them was like 105, something like that. But it was over 3 hours of screening. And I can't watch that much crappy French cinema in one sitting. So I get home and I'm like, I'm not going to do any more work tonight. I want to play... Final Fantasy VII just came out, was coming out on Switch. And I had it preloaded. And I thought, like most games, it would unlock at midnight Eastern, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I got home around 11 o'clock, and I'm like, which for Iowa time would be midnight Eastern. And I'm like, okay, Final Fantasy VII has to be unlocked. And I go to the Switch, and it's not unlocked. And I'm like, oh, shit. And I kind of keep checking, and it's not unlocking. It didn't unlock until, like, late afternoon Tuesday. They fucked it up or something. But, yeah. So what I wound up doing that night is I turn on my PS4. I've been trying to wean myself off Destiny. So I'm like, I've got my Destiny patches on. I'm not trying to get the actual thing. I'm chewing my Destiny gum. And I launched something I bought in a PlayStation Plus sale a couple weeks ago, which is the new collection they did of Castlevania Rondo of Blood and Castlevania Symphony of the Night. This is similar to a collection they did on PSP back in the day, but the PSP version was like this kind of weird 3D remake of Rondo of Blood that I can never get into. I know you could unlock the original, but you had to get through part of the game, and it's really hard, and I never did. This is just the original PC Engine version of Rondo of Blood, and basically the original Symphony of the Night with the Japanese voices and updated subtitles, so Dracula does not say, "What is a man?
Miserable little pile of secrets!"
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so I played all of Castlevania Rondo of Blood this week, and I never got to Final Fantasy VII, because by the time Final Fantasy VII unlocked, I was in love with this fucking Castlevania game. Sean, Rondo of Blood, you've recommended it, lots of people have recommended it. That's one of the best fucking games I've ever played in my life.
Yeah, Rondo of Blood is real fucking good. We've never talked about it before on the podcast, because I don't think we've ever had opportunity to, but yeah, I played forever ago the Dracula Chronicles X collection, the one you referenced, that was a PSP game. I got it on the Vita, and it's a 3D remake of Rondo of Blood, but you can unlock the original Rondo of Blood and the and Symphony of the Night in it. Although it's kind of weird, like you have to like find Symphony of the Night like in the level, like you find the box art as like an unlockable that you go and like pick up. So it's kind of weird in that sense. But it's a really good collection of those games for people that have a Vita and don't mind playing a little bit of the 3D remake, which is fine, but not as like probably not the thing you really want. But yeah, Rondo of Blood is fucking amazing. I'm not like a huge Castlevania guy, but of the Castlevania games I have played, Rondo of Blood is my favorite.
Yeah, I have not been a huge Castlevania guy in the past. I want to get into it. There's the Bloodstained game that's finally coming out this year from Koji Igarashi, the main Castlevania guy, and I definitely want to try that out when it comes out. They also did that Bloodstained Curse of the Moon, which is like the 8-bit kind of thing, and I picked that up on Switch this week because it was like $2 or something, and I'm like, oh, I want to play this at some point. I heard it was really good. So I played Rondo of Blood. I'm planning on playing Symphony of the Night at some point. I was going to get into that this weekend, but Yoshi was even better than I was expecting, so I've been mostly putting my time into Yoshi. But yeah, Rondo of Blood is amazing. I'm amazed they kind of ever tried to do a 3D remake of it, because the original PC Engine graphics are fucking jaw-dropping. That and Symphony of the Night. I love that period when everyone else was doing 3D, but some of these consoles with more horsepower, people were just making better 2D games. And it's like, yeah. I wish we still did that. I mean, we do kind of in like the indie scene, but they look so good. And the Rondo of Blood soundtrack is... I'll spoil it. If we do top video game soundtracks, Rondo of Blood is Garen fucking T to spot on that. Oh my god, it's good.
A fucking min, man. Yeah. I was listening to it just like a week ago. I was re-listening to that soundtrack.
It's so good. And the game is so ridiculously hard, but really fun. I unlocked Maria Renard, and I wound up playing most of the game with Maria because the game is really tough. And I want to go back, because there's all these other routes you can take and everything. Yeah. So when I say I beat Rondo of Blood, you know, I did like one clear playthrough. And even with Maria, it's hard. She makes it easier. She does not make it easy. But yeah, it's either way you play it, like it's just a trip, man. It's got such creative level design. It is challenging, but very rarely feels unfair to me. That music, that atmosphere, just how much variety there is visually throughout the levels, not to mention between the levels. Seriously, just like, I was blown away by this thing. If that game came out today and Konami was still making games, and Konami was like, this is like our Sonic Mania or something, I would believe that it was made today.
Mm-hmm.
It just has not aged. It's amazing.
Yeah, because like one thing that's interesting about that game for me and like my memories of playing it was when I played that game was right around when I played the original Dark Souls. There was something very similar about those, even though obviously like Rondo's a 2D game and, you know, made forever ago and it's not a big RPG and it's none of that kind of stuff. But there's something about like the philosophy of the very exacting gameplay, the very precise gameplay of Rondo of Blood that feels like was a touchstone for Miyazaki's team in making those like Demon Souls and Dark Souls games. And the same thing with like Sekiro. It's like they're difficult games, but there is something so precise about them that every time you fuck up, you know that you fucked up, and you all constantly like take that as a learning experience and approach it again and be like, okay, like now I know how to deal with this boss's attack, or now I know how to get through this area without taking as much damage, and constantly refining how you play the game. There's something so precise about the way they're designed that it's that thing where it's like most games I would not put up with some of that bullshit, but with those games, you know, there's such like a sort of authorial hand on you of like, no, like you can do this, you can get through this, you just have to take everything and learn from it and not get frustrated by it. And Rondo of Blood is one of those games that got me to be able to accept that kind of game design.
Absolutely. And I actually think, you know, now if you're on Twitter and you follow video game people, the debate about whether From Software should have an easy mode in their games has kind of flared up again around Sekiro. Mm-hmm. And there's back and forth on it. I actually think the Maria Renard character in Rondo of Blood is a really good lesson in how you can do that. Because, again, she does not make the game easy, but she gives you, more than just, like, making it easier, is she gives you a slightly different play style. Like, she's more mobile, she has the double jump, she's a little more ranged. There are sacrifices, like, you can get hit less with her, but you just have more ways to avoid it. And I just found that, like, she adopted to my play style a little better. and it allowed me to access all those things you just said about the game and make it a little more accessible. That feels to me like the kind of thing you would want if they were to do an easy mode with something in like the From Software games.
Yeah, as opposed to just like the thing that most games do with difficulty, which is like, you know, you pick easy so you have like 110% health and all the enemies have 85% health and they do 0.95 damage or whatever and like little number modifiers instead of doing that. Because again, like these games are very precisely designed around those aspects. Instead of just like tweaking all those things, I agree, like finding other avenues for players to be able to access the content without like changing necessarily all the enemies and all those variables, but maybe giving the player different abilities or a different perspective for which they can play. I agree that that's a better solution for a game like this than just easy mode, super easy mode, whatever like difficulty options other games usually employ.
I also want to say, give a shout out, the DualShock 4 sturdy controller. Sturdy mm-hmm. controller. I know this because I threw that controller several times, primarily when I was still stuck with Richter Belmont and his, you know, unilateral whip that only goes one direction, and I was having trouble with it. Sturdy, you know, my DualShock 3, you know the controller I accidentally kind of broke with Last of Us, and all I did to that thing was slam it on the table a little bit. I tossed my DualShock 4 across the fucking room this weekend. Fine. Nothing. It got a little paint on it from the wall, but it's fine.
It's maybe a really good thing that you never fully took my advice and tried to play through all of Rondo on the PSP version. You don't want to chuck the Vita. Like, the Vita seems like a pretty sturdy piece of kit, but you don't want to just throw it across the room.
I've told you the story. My brother broke my Vita because I got a new Vita, gave him my old one. He broke it just tossing it into bed one night. When he like walked into his room and tossed it onto the bed, and I guess it was at a bad... He wasn't even angry or anything. It was just like that kind of thing when you come home and you like throw your phone on the bed. He did that with his Vita, and it was at a bad angle, and the screen shattered. So, yeah. Anyway, all right. I also wanted to talk about a listener recommended to me this week on Twitter, Levi. On Twitter recommended to me the Fire Emblem Premium Arrange album. This is a new Fire Emblem Arrangements album that came out in Japan just this past week, but you can go find it online through various means, as well as purchase it legally if you want from CD Japan or Amazon Japan or something. And it is basically, I wanted to mention it because it is so good, and it is basically, you remember how for Persona 3 and 4 they did the reincarnation albums? Where they took music and had now, you know, live musicians doing it in a studio and it sounded really cool?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is for Fire Emblem, and it's tracks from across the whole Fire Emblem series, including some of the newer games that are out in the US. And I think the main reason Levi sent it to me is because Yumi Kawamura, the vocalist from Persona 3, does all of the vocals on the Fire Emblem Fates songs. Oh, good God. Yumi Kawamura is a goddess. Her voice is amazing. There's a song that is our opening theme this week on the show called Dusk Falls, which is the main battle theme from Fates. And they put vocals on it. It doesn't have vocals in the game. They wrote vocals for it. She sings it. She is fierce, like spine tingling on that song. It is so fucking good. That album is so great. We don't usually do just like straight up music reviews on this show, but the Fire Emblem Premium Arrange album, I mean, the first track on it is, I think, some of the battle music from the early like Famicom games, and it's just like dudes shredding on guitar. I love it. It's so good.
Great. Yeah, I saw that exchange on Twitter, but I have not taken the time to actually listen to any of it. But yeah, I'm excited to... I have a new album to go listen to.
Absolutely.
As we said before, video game music, pretty fucking good.
Pretty fucking good. And last thing I wanted to talk about, Sean, is do a quick check-in with my superhero shows on the CW.
All right.
Because I am all caught up on Supergirl, which is the one I usually try to watch live more than other shows. And I'm almost all the way caught up on The Flash. When I last left The Flash, it was right after the musical episode where Barry Allen and Kara Danvers get trapped in a dream by the Music Meister. And, you know, I love these shows. And so I had to catch up end of season 3, all of season 4. They're midway through season 5 now. And I'm midway through. I'm a little behind where season 5 is, but I'm catching up. And I want to talk about The Flash in a second because it's just such a fascinating show to me. But I also wanted to mention Supergirl right now is in the middle of an arc where they've introduced Lex Luthor onto the show. I thought you'd find this interesting, Sean, because, you know, they've slowly been getting clearly like permission from Warner Brothers to do more with Superman characters because they did Superman a few seasons ago. In this year's crossover event, they did Superman and Lois Lane, and they had their own Lois Lane. And now they introduced Lex Luthor. And Lex Luthor is played by John Cryer, who was kind of like I think for a lot of people, a confusing choice because he's best known lately for Two and a Half Men,
yeah,
the Charlie Sheen show that he was on. But he's done lots of different things over his career. And actually, one of his first credits ever was as one of Lex Luthor's flunkies in Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Wow.
And anyone who had to suffer in the making of that movie, I think should get a chance for redemption on a modern superhero show. I think that is more than fair.
I agree. I now want them to like do some weird continuity thing where he's actually is that henchman from an alternate universe, whichever universe the Christopher Reeve Superman movies took place in, and he traveled through some dimensional gate here, and there was no Lex Luthor in the Supergirl universe, so he took that like mantle and decided, well, I've seen Lex Luthor, like Gene Hackman, Lex Luthor up close, personal. I know how to do this shit. And like, that's his origin story. That's what I want those shows to do.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. They're doing it this fall. They could work that plot in.
Yeah. You keep on telling me how comic booky these shows are. They will truly have achieved proper comic book status if that is what they fucking do. Because that is the shit that a fucking comic book would do.
I mean, they went so far as to, in this year's crossover, Sean, have John Wesley Shipp, who was the Flash in the 90s and has been on the Flash in various capacities, play the literal Flash from the 90s TV show, thus canonizing him as the Flash of an alternate Earth.
Nice.
So they've done that, basically. But anyway, John Cryer's Lex Luthor is really, really good. He's a great addition to the show. And the last episode they did, so we're recording this Sunday night. The show airs while we are recording. So last week's episode, when you hear this, it was called The House of L, just the letter L, like a pun on The House of L is obviously the house of Superman and Supergirl. And it's basically, the plot of the episode was showing how Lex Luthor, who is in prison when Supergirl starts, like all of his stuff with Superman went down before Supergirl begins, and he's in prison, but we find out he's been orchestrating a lot of the events of season 4 from behind prison in a very Lex Luthor way, right? Mm-hmm. And it also tied in this other plot thread where at the end of season 3, Supergirl came into contact with Black Kryptonite, and the Black Kryptonite created a clone Supergirl who woke up out in Russia, and or like a fake Russian Soviet state. It's not actual Russia, it's like Kaznia or something. They made up a fake state. And we've been kind of getting hints of this character over the last, like, 15 episodes or so, but we are not sure what her deal is. And this episode was all about Lex Luthor going to that Soviet bloc state and mentoring this, like, weird clone Supergirl who has no memories, but is basically Kara Danvers underneath, and turning her against America and trying to turn her into a weapon. And it is straight up the best Lex Luthor story I've ever seen. I am not a comic book person, so I can't say I know a ton of those, but just through all the movies and TV shows I've seen, it is easily the most interesting Lex Luthor story I've seen. And then the alternate Supergirl, who she's not called anything in the show, but everyone's calling her Red Daughter because it's kind of a version of the Red Sun story arc from the comics where Superman is a Soviet agent. And Melissa Benoist, who plays Supergirl, is so good as Red Daughter because I think everyone assumed, because she's really good at playing evil versions of Supergirl. They've done that like 5 different times, as you do. And she's really good at it. And everyone assumed Red Daughter was going to be another evil Supergirl, but she's not. She's a really interesting character. And the relationship she and Lex have is so intelligent and like deeply felt and like convincing to me. It's a really good story. Like, it's easily one of the 2 or 3 best episodes Supergirl has ever made. If you've never watched the show, that might be just a good 45 minutes to watch because it's actually a pretty good story regardless of where it goes. I was just very impressed by it because there's a lot of heavy lifting to do in a story like that because they're kind of rewriting the story of the season in 1 hour, but it's really extraordinarily well done, and I'm glad that they have not just a good version of Lex Luthor, but like legitimately a pretty great one, like easily the best since Gene Hackman in live action stuff. And, you know, Gene Hackman was more of a comedic Lex Luthor. John Cryer is funny, but his Lex Luthor is a threat and it's done very well.
Awesome. Yeah. It's good to know that there's a good Lex Luthor out there in the world again. After what we were subjected to recently.
Yes.
In the movies.
I know. It's because our other 21st century Lex Luthors are Jesse Eisenberg, no, and Kevin Spacey, who was pretty good, but we can't enjoy that anymore, Sean.
Yeah.
We just cannot. There's a whole thread of that movie where he kidnaps a child and is alone with him on a yacht. No, does not work anymore.
Superman Returns became a very problematic movie in the past couple of years.
It really
as a whole.
It did. It did. But anyway, for The Flash, Sean, I love The Flash. It's a good TV show. It is the most comic booky comic book show ever made. It's ridiculous. I just finished watching season 4. Season 4 was really good. That's the season where Barry and company fight the thinker, Clifford DeVoe, and that was a pretty good arc. They definitely made good on their promise. Season 2 and 3 get very weirdly dark, and they decided, let's lighten it up a little bit, and I think season 4, without sacrificing gravitas, made the show fun again, which is nice. And season 5 has been pretty good so far, too. Season 5 is where Barry and Iris West's daughter, Nora, runs back from the future as an adult and meets her parents and sticks around, and now they have not had their daughter yet, but they have their, like, adult daughter in their lives, which is the only time I've legitimately gotten frustrated at the time travel mechanics of The Flash, because meeting your, like, adult daughter before you have conceived that child would automatically erase their existence, right?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, like, it would get in your head. Nothing would go the way it would have gone in the other timeline. So, you know, it's not that big a problem, but I am thinking about it.
Well, maybe they've taken that into account. Maybe that's not really what her identity is. Maybe there's something more sinister going on. Who knows?
We shall find out. But, Sean, I want to go back to season 3 of The Flash. This season has been pretty maligned by fans. I like it more than I think a lot of people did, but it is problematic. And I just want to play a fun game where I'm going to try, without notes, to describe the plot of season 3 of The Flash, because it is the most convoluted fucking thing I've ever seen on television.
Great, yeah. As someone who has not seen any of The Flash at all, I'm sure I will be of great help to you
okay.
in this endeavor.
But you know, like, comic books and stuff, so...
Yes.
You will recognize some of these words, I'm sure. Yes.
We can only hope.
Okay. So season 3 of The Flash starts with Barry... It starts at the end... There's a cliffhanger in season 2. So season 2 ends... Barry's dad has just been killed by Zoom, who was the big bad of season 2. And this was Barry's dad only a year after he got out of prison for the false murder of Barry's mother, who was actually killed by the Reverse Flash, blah, 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 right? And so yeah. Barry's very sad, and he decides, fuck it, I have these powers, I'm going to run into the past and stop the Reverse Flash from killing my mom, and therefore my mom will be alive, my dad will never be imprisoned, and my dad will never die, right? So that's the end
Makes
of season
sense.
2. Season 3 starts with an episode called Flashpoint, where they do a sort of mini version of the arc from the comics, where Barry's mother and father are alive, his life is nice now, but it's, you know, very, like, It's a Wonderful Life in reverse sort of thing. He starts to realize that now that he's happy, everyone else he knew in his life is miserable, and everything's gone wrong, and there's a bunch of bad shit. And so he has to... The season 3 premiere ends with the darkest moment The Flash will ever have to do, where Barry goes back in time and stops himself from saving his mother and has to watch her die. Which I feel like was maybe... Maybe they never should have done that. That's such a dark thing to put on your main character. But whatever. So he fixes the timeline, he comes back, but in fixing the timeline, a bunch of stuff, there were still ripple effects. So, like, and they're not minor things. The problem is, and this is why people malign season 3, is Barry Allen, that, like, initial mistake of season 3 is such a monstrously horrible thing he did. It's really tough to get behind Barry Allen, because literally the entire plot of season 3 is putting out the fires caused by Barry Allen's selfishness. And the first one is he comes back, and what kinds of things are changed? Well, you know, there's some more minor things, like Iris is really mad at her dad, Joe, and he's got to try to, you know, make Iris and Joe get along again. But then there's also stuff like his buddy Cisco, one of the main characters on the show, his brother is dead now. So Cisco is pretty mad at Barry, because Barry has to reveal, hey, before I fucked with the timeline, your brother was alive, and you guys had been estranged for a while, but you were friends again. So that's pretty fucked up. It even extends to the other shows in the CW DC verse, because on Arrow, one of the main characters, I think it's John Diggle, who is like the, you know, co-lead on Arrow behind Stephen Amell, behind Oliver Queen. He and his wife had, I think, a son in the show, and the son becomes a daughter, And so their child is erased from existence and they have a new child. And in the crossover, Barry has to like break that news to them. And it's kind of weird because there's no time to process that because that's not Barry's show. So he fucked up a lot of shit.
Why doesn't he just keep it to himself? Like no, like right, like nobody else would ever be able to know that there was a whole other timeline. Like what, he should just be like,
so,
I'm just going to keep this to myself. I'm not going to go. Like you're just causing more shit.
Here's
if
why
you go around telling people that there was a better universe that existed, and then I fucked everything up and time travel stuff. So it's like your life is kind of shit now, and it would have been way better if I hadn't done something that you have no knowledge of.
So here's why he can't do that, Sean.
Okay.
A new enemy appears in Central City, Dr. Alchemy. And Dr. Alchemy is giving people the meta powers that they had in the Flashpoint timeline Barry created. So this meta, Dr. Alchemy, can sense what the alternate timeline Barry Allen made was, where other people had different meta powers. And he is now restoring them from the alternate timeline to the main timeline, and all these bad metas are showing up around Central City. And that's why Barry Allen has to come clean.
I still don't see why he has to come clean. I still don't see like why he can't just be like, no, I don't know what he's talking about. Like, he's just giving people superpowers. There are lots of people that have the superpower to give people superpowers. I don't know, like, weird timeline bullshit. I don't know.
Okay, so the first half of season three is a little bit of a blur to me because I watched it 2 years ago and then finished it this month. The Dr. Alchemy arc is you find out, so there's also one of the like products of Barry's time travel fuckery is that he has a new partner at CCPD where he works as a CSI, and the new partner, I don't remember his name, he's Tom Felton from Harry Potter who played Malfoy. So Malfoy from Harry Potter is there, and he is Barry's new partner at the CSI lab, and over the course of the first half of the season you find out Dr. Alchemy is actually Malfoy. But
wow, shocker, he's evil. Okay,
I know. Yeah. Well, he's not actually. He's a good dude. Dr. Alchemy is like a spirit thing who is using his body. All right?
Okay, yes.
Yes. Now, in the course of this, you also have the introduction of the Wally West character, who obviously becomes Kid Flash in the comics.
Yes.
And so Wally West, who is Iris's brother in this version, comes to town, and I forget the exact like chain of events, but in separating Dr. Alchemy from Julian, from the Malfoy character, from Tom Felton, we meet the real big bad of the season, who is actually Dr. Alchemy, who is Savitar, the god of speed, who is this like speedster in this big like silver armor, and he kidnaps Wally West and gives him speedster powers, and that's how Wally becomes Kid Flash. But this is all just part of Savitar's bigger plan. So all of that happens. There's no Dr. Alchemy anymore. Julian joins the team, and he's a good guy now. Also in the midst of this, because of Barry's time travel fuckery, Caitlin, his friend, becomes Killer Frost, who is like this like ice demon. And that's all. And that's a whole Jekyll and Hyde thing. It's really bad for Caitlin. Barry really fucked a lot of people over this season, is the main point. All right? But now they're trying to fight this dude, Savitar, who's really fast and really powerful. And over the course of the season, they learn the origin of Savitar is that he was a future enemy of the Flash, and future Flash threw Savitar to capture him into the Speed Force. The Speed Force is this thing introduced on, I'm sure it's in the comics too. It is the thing that all the speedsters are tapping into that they get their speed from, and it is like this alternate dimension or this like pocket universe or something like that from which the power of speed comes from. And so Barry Allen in the future took Savitar and chucked him in the Speed Force and imprisoned him there, and that's why Savitar is so angry. And Savitar, this is what I was forgetting, does not have a physical body because he's stuck in the Speed Force, so he is using his psychic powers. We never find out how he has those, but he has psychic powers, and that's how he was affecting Julian and creating Dr. Alchemy. And he specifically made Wally West into Kid Flash so that Wally West would take the Philosopher's Stone, which is the thing they have to find to defeat Dr. Alchemy, that's a whole little arc, and chuck it into the Speed Force in the belief that if he throws it into the Speed Force, then Savitar will be defeated. But actually, because Savitar is trapped in the Speed Force, when Kid Flash throws the Philosopher's Stone in there, Savitar is able to escape the Speed Force and put Wally West back in the Speed Force, and Wally West is now trapped there, and Savitar is out in the real world. It has not gotten convoluted yet. We're nowhere near convoluted yet.
Okay, and all that what you just said, like, that all happened. So Wally yes. West is in the Speed Force. Yep. Savitar is out here being, yeah. like, evil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Savitar is really angry at Barry Allen for trapping him in the Speed Force, right?
Yes, although it was future Barry Allen, so it feels like he should not be taking it out on present-day Barry Allen. That's just kind of fucked up.
It is kind of fucked up, but, you know, he's the bad guy. Now, in the course of all of this, Barry Allen accidentally, I do not remember the plot context of this, he accidentally runs so fast he goes into the future, and he sees in a few months, it would be like May, because it's the end of the season of television, he sees Savitar murdering his girlfriend and fiancée, Iris West. And so Savitar is going to murder Iris West. They start bringing in all the, like, fixed point in time bullshit from Doctor Who. And this is, like, a fixed event in the future where Savitar is going to murder Iris and Barry is not fast enough to stop it. And so the entire back half of the season is this incredibly dark trudge to the end where every episode they repeat the flash forward where Iris is skewered in the chest with Savitar's, like, you know, arm, stick, sword thing, right? And mm-hmm. and Barry's like, I don't know if I can save you, Iris. And Iris is like, it's okay, we'll figure it out together, and all of that, right? So, yeah. The musical episode came right in the middle of this. In context, it is a tonally very dissonant from the rest of that season. But anyway, so they have to figure out, okay, how do we save Iris? This is going to happen in the future. They know that's going to happen. And Savitar, in doing that, apparently, is going to, like, ascend to godhood, and that's his big plan or something. Because what we find out is Savitar needs to kill Iris, because it is only by killing Iris that he creates a dark enough version of Barry Allen in the future for Barry to do the horrible things he does and throw Savitar into the Speed Force, which thus creates Savitar in the present.
Okay. So Savitar was born via a time paradox and, like, a time loop he has to perpetuate in order to exist.
Kind of, yes. So that this is, like, part one of it. We get part two later in the season. Part two is that Savitar finally takes off the armor and we find out who he is. And Savitar is Barry Allen.
I should see that coming.
Yeah, so Savitar is, and it is really funny because it is Barry Allen with dyed black hair. So he looks like an emo dude and a, like, facial scar, like a burn on his face, like an acid burn. And it's, you should look up a picture of it, just Grant Gustin Savitar. It's very funny. And I forget how they lay it all out, but the plot basically is that Savitar was not always Barry Allen, but when Barry Allen of the future fought Savitar, whose identity I guess is unknown, he had to create time remnants of himself, which is basically where he runs so fast, he creates, it's kind of like Tenshin Han in Dragon Ball Z, he creates mm-hmm. extra versions of himself, and the extra versions help him defeat Savitar and throw Savitar into the Speed Force. But one of those time remnants survives and is ostracized by the rest of Team Flash, and therefore becomes very sad and mopey and angry, and he becomes, in some way from all this, he becomes Savitar because he's really angry and mean and comes to the past to destroy Barry Allen. And that is the time paradox, is that Savitar was not always Barry Allen, but because Barry Allen created time remnants and then abandoned one of the time remnants, one of those time remnants becomes the new Savitar and is running around time trying to fuck shit up. And he has to make Barry Allen really dark and sad in the present so that future Barry Allen will abandon him. So that is how he maintains his existence.
So, but how did he come into existence in the first place if he is necessary to make Barry Allen dark and evil enough to make a Savitar?
It makes no sense, Sean.
Okay, so they don't, so I just, like, to be clear, they do not directly address that bootstrap paradox. They just let that be a...
They say the word time paradox at some point, but no, they do not get into the weeds of it.
Okay. They just needed to have an opening 5 minutes with Peter Capaldi talking into the camera about bootstrap paradoxes, and then it would all be fine.
It is very confusing. They ultimately... I don't even remember how they defeat Savitar, and I just watched it. It's something about... they try to, like, accept him into the family, but he doesn't want that, and then he's trying to do all this shit with the Speed Force, and then Sisko invents a speed cannon, and they shoot him with the speed cannon, and something happens there, and then finally Iris shoots him in the back, and he disappears. I don't know. It's weird.
He doesn't kill Iris.
No, he doesn't kill Iris. They save Iris. What they have to do is that H.R. Wells... So every season... So Tom Cavanagh, who is a cast member on the show, plays a different version of a character who is original to the show. He's not a comics character, named Harrison Wells. And every season it's a Harrison Wells from a different alternate universe. And in this season, it's a character named HR, and HR, like, has this technology that allows him to, like, look like other people, and he pretends to be Iris and gets killed, and that is what, like, breaks the paradox and all this stuff.
Okay. I thought it was going to be that they just put, like, that Barry and Iris were inside a, like, a life, were shrunk down and put into size, a life-size robot replica that looked exactly like Iris that got stabbed. I thought that's what it was going to be.
It is very Doctor Who season 6.
Yeah, but it seems like it.
But someone does actually die. Now, Tom Cavanaugh just comes back the next season as a new character, but, you know,
So someone dies on the show, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then the season ends with the Speed Force, now that they save Wally at some point, long story, but now the Speed Force does not have a speedster in it, and apparently the Speed Force needs a speedster imprisoned inside it, or else it will collapse and destroy the universe. So the Speed Force starts, like, acting up, and Barry decides, you know, I've fucked up a lot of shit this year, I'm gonna go into the Speed Force, and I'll be trapped there, and, you know, I love all you guys, and he does that. And it is very, very end of Buffy season 5-esque, like, where Buffy sacrifices herself and dies. And I just have to tell you about the best internet comment I ever have fucking seen on a TV review, which is, I was looking at one of the reviews of the Flash season 3 finale, and again, it ends very Buffy season 5. He has to jump into the Speed Force, and he is gone now, right? And so someone wrote online, because Buffy season 5 ends with the shot of her tombstone where it says, you know, Buffy Summers, date to date, she saved the world a lot. Remember that, Sean?
Yeah.
So someone wrote, so Barry Allen, you know, date to date, he fucked with the timeline a lot. And that would have been a pretty perfect ending to The Flash, honestly.
Yeah, because I definitely see what you're saying with, like, how you described the season of. It sounds like it is very hard to be, like, pro-Barry Allen. Considering that, like, not only did the season start with him fucking everything up about the timeline, but everything, but the villain is him.
Yeah.
And so, like, kind of everything that is wrong and evil in season 3 is just caused by Barry Allen or another version to Barry Allen.
I mean, literally the entire, that nothing that happens, there's not even one-off stories in that season that are not in some way directly created by either his past or future actions. And it is just something that is a general storytelling trope that superhero shows and movies do sometimes that annoys me, is I don't like it when like Age of Ultron does this. I don't like it when the giant world-ending threat is what the superheroes did, because then you just have to start asking yourself, well, wouldn't it be better if there were no superheroes? You know? And it kind of breaks the illusion of fun you have watching this.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, a hard story to do, and you can only do it every once in a while. Like, I think in the comics, it, like, has worked better for me than I've ever seen a movie or TV show do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, season 4 is much better. Season 5 is pretty good so far. The current version of Harrison Wells is a Frenchman named Sherlock Wells, who is a detective and has a ridiculous French accent, and I'm enjoying that.
Interesting. Now I'm just curious, how does he get out of the Speed Force in the beginning of season 4?
Sisko invents a thingamajig that they toss into the Speed Force, and it tricks the Speed Force into thinking it has a speedster in it.
Oh.
That's it.
Oh, that's really disappointing. I thought there'd be something cool.
No. I mean, it is kind of very much like it's actually the direct inverse of season 6 of Buffy, where in season 6, Buffy comes back and she's really depressed the whole season because she got pulled out of heaven, as she tells us about in song. And in The Flash season 4, Barry gets out of the Speed Force and is really happy and optimistic because he has, like, a new lease on life. And they use that to kind of tonally reboot the show, because the show did get really unnecessarily dark in seasons 2 and 3. And it was the right decision. But yes, it is, like, in the first 10 minutes, like, Sisko has a thingamajig and they save him.
Is Wally West, like, properly Kid Flash? Does he have, like, the costume and everything?
Yeah, he has the costume. He is there in season 3. In season 4, he leaves and is on Legends of Tomorrow, the spinoff show. Okay. As Kid Flash, and then right now that actor is not doing anything with the DC shows. He could come back at some point, but, like, the story is Wally is out in the world, like, on his own hero's journey, basically.
Sure.
Yeah. So they ultimately, like, they had too many speedsters for one show, so there was kind of nothing for Wally to do. But, you know, it's fun.
Yeah. As someone who has no attachment to that TV show or, like, the actors or anything on that side of it, for me, what I would do is just keep Barry Allen trapped in the Speed Force and just have Wally become the new Flash, because Barry Allen from the comic books, Barry Allen is a very dull, boring character, and Wally is very funny and cool, and Wally West is a much better Flash.
Sadly, in the show, Wally West is kind of a boring character.
They fucked it up then. Yeah, well, right. If they made Barry Allen good, then they didn't fuck it up.
They did.
That's
make Barry
actually
Allen
what
good.
You want Barry Allen to be an interesting character. You don't want the sidekick to be more interesting than the main character.
Yeah, Grant Gustin is really good as Barry Allen. Barry Allen, as you can probably tell from my synopsis of season 3, waxes and wanes in character quality. But if you've got a guy in Grant Gustin who has like movie star charisma, and that's what you need, right?
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I just had to get that off my chest because that is one of the most ridiculous TV season plots I've ever seen. And, you know, yeah.
I like it when other shows do Doctor Who stuff. Or, like specifically do, like, Stephen Moffat Doctor Who stuff. Like, I like just seeing that happen. It's like when, at the end of Doctor Strange, the movie, you just realize, oh, they just did... this is just Doctor Who stuff they started doing. It's like Heaven Sent or whatever.
I will say, though, it does make you appreciate Stephen Moffat even more, because we can all say, like, Stephen Moffat got too convoluted at times. There's a clarity to his writing that you really miss when someone who is not as talented as Stephen Moffat tries to do it.
Yeah.
So, there you go. All right, you want to do some news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
Well, we're going to start with something very sad, which is the great French director, one of the greatest French directors, Agnès Varda, passed away this week at age 90. If you follow film Twitter or film news at all, I'm sure your feeds were inundated with this. Agnès Varda, you know, I think in a lot of the obituaries I read said, you know, she was a pioneering, you know, player in the French New Wave. That is not inaccurate. She is definitely of that period, but she very much transcends the New Wave in a way that I think like a Truffaut or a Godard do not, in a lot of different ways, because she exists before the New Wave. Her first feature is 1956. The New Wave generally is agreed to begin in 59. Her first feature is La Pointe Courte. You should absolutely watch it. And she continues evolving all the way up to today. Her last movie came out in 2017 when she was 89 years old. Faces Places was nominated for an Oscar, so she was working her entire life. She generally, I would say, if you want to be technical, is more aligned with a group called the Left Bank, which is a group that is associated with the New Wave but kind of is outside of it. That's also Alain René, who made Hiroshima Mon Amour, or Chris Marker, who made La Jetée. And I would say it's those directors, like Agnès Varda, are people who, unlike the main figures of the French New Wave, are not as obsessed with, you know, intertextuality, with referencing other films. They're not attacking the establishment as much. They're not as referential. And as part of that, I think their movies have aged much, 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 much better. Agnès Varda is, just simply put, one of the best filmmakers who ever walked this earth. I am mainly familiar with her early stuff. I've seen some of her later films, and they're magnificent, and I can't wait to watch more of them. But, you know, just her first run of three films is La Pointe Courte, which is like kind of a hybrid documentary fiction film about this small seaside town in France, and it is incredible. Her second film is Cleo from 5 to 7, which is a story told in real time about a young woman named Cleo who is awaiting the results of a biopsy that might tell her she has cancer, and she is basically wandering the streets of Paris kind of on a, you know, long, dark, existential night of the soul, and it is one of the best films ever made. And then her third film is called La Bonheur. I've had Agnès Varda a lot on the mind lately because I just did a big presentation on La Bonheur in my French New Wave class, and that is her first film in color. And I said this in my presentation, it is one of the single most searing indictments of male privilege that you will ever see on film. That movie has fucking teeth, and those teeth are as sharp today as they were in 1965 when it was made. And her work past that point is incredible as well. She eventually starts experimenting more with documentary form. One of those I know is, I think it's from 2000, called The Gleaners and I, which is where she took like an early digital camera and went around some of the, like, I think it's an area around Paris, and is talking to this like group of people called The Gleaners, who are people who like live on the streets. They're ostensibly homeless, but sometimes by choice, and they, you know, pick up trash and recycling and things like that. And just an amazing, interesting, reflexive piece of work. She is such an innately talented filmmaker. She was a photographer before she ever went into film and has such a keen eye for visuals and visual storytelling. She is deeply rooted in, you know, in a classical education, so, you know, novels and paintings and things like that. So when she tends to reference other works of art, it's not recent cinema. It is much longer standing, you know, paintings and things like that. Like La Bonne Heure is very much inspired its look by Impressionist paintings, like Renoir or Van Gogh or anything like that. And yeah, she's just one of the greatest, I think, within film academia. People definitely know her. And certainly in the circles of people who watch the Criterion Collection, people know her. But she, I think, still has not been elevated to the point of some of her contemporaries. And that's just pure sexism, because she's better than them. I don't think François Truffaut or Jean-Luc Godard can hold a fucking candle to the talent Agnès Varda had. And I think that about a lot of French films of the time and now. She just is... There's some people who just have it. She had it. There is no pretension about her work. She tackles sometimes very heady issues, but there is not this sense of self-importance and self-righteousness that I get from a lot of French New Wave films and films of that period. You know, just she stands outside of time. She lived a long, amazing life. 90 years old is crazy, and she was working, like we said, right up until the end of it. There were so many good stories about her on Twitter this week, and, you know, if you have not seen one of her films, any of the ones I just referenced would be good places to start. The Criterion channel is launching next week, and they're going to have all of her stuff. I mean, maybe not all of it, but Criterion does own a great deal of her work. Certainly all of her early work, and, you know, no time like the present to catch up on one of the greats.
Yeah, I've never really delved much into French film, but this seems like a good opportunity for me. As you said, like, I was thinking about that when the news came out, because I was not familiar with her stuff, and sort of seeing, like, reading some of the stuff about her movies, and realizing, oh, wait, right, shit, like, that Criterion streaming thing is going to be up soon. I can watch these. So I will definitely try to make some time to dig into her stuff, because her movies seem a lot more interesting to me than a lot of the French movies from that period. It's just like there's something about that era of cinema, like Godard and stuff like that, that just has never really attracted me. There's something about her, from what I've heard, that seems just much more interesting to me from like an outside perspective, as someone that has no real, you know, interest or like has never really participated in that specific era of film history.
You know, people like Godard and Truffaut, This is reductive, but it is how I feel. They were trying to make points. Agnès Varda was trying to make art. And there's a difference to that for me. You know, you've probably heard me complain about it before. There is... Part of why I feel she stands apart from the French New Wave is the French New Wave is such a boys' club. And it's, I think, you know, thematic and stylistic essence is so built on a kind of male gaze, masturbatory celebration of male obsessions and perpetuations, and a very disturbing view of women. There's so much misogyny in the French New Wave, and that's not there in Varda. Varda, you know, if she wanted to be pretentious, she earned it. She was very, very smart and educated and had all the chops, but it's not there in her work. It's I think there's so much less, you know, of a director trying to tell you, I'm great, here's why. And here's why the rest of you are wrong. That's not her goal. And I just think her work stands the test of time. You don't have to be into French cinema or historical cinema to watch Cleo from 5 to 7 and be blown away by what she's pulling off there. So,
yeah.
You know, we love you, Agnès. It's one of those deaths that kind of, if you're in film school, kind of rocks your world for a couple of days, because I'll tell you, especially this semester in the class I'm in, I don't know how many days have gone by that I haven't gone to campus and talked about Agnès Varda. So, yeah, it's amazing we got to live in her time, is my view on this. So I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. All right. Sean, you want to move on?
Yeah, what else is going on?
So the Wall Street Journal this week, this is moving over to video games, where we're going to be for the rest of this segment. The Wall Street Journal reported, and Eurogamer later followed up, echoing their report, that Nintendo is not just planning one new model of the Nintendo Switch this year, but two. And it would be a smaller Switch that would replace sort of the 3DS space. It would fill in that lower-cost portable place in the market. And a improved version. They do not, in the report, specifically say it would be like the Switch Pro, but everyone is using kind of the Pro moniker, because that's what the PS4 Pro is called, and that's just kind of how we think of the Xbox One X as well. It's interesting to me. I think everyone was surprised by this, because the smaller new portable one made total sense. We've talked about it before, Sean. It's like, that seems like a natural next step for Nintendo. An improved, you know, possibly prosumer Switch, it's kind of hard to know what that would be. So I'm just curious what... I have thoughts on this as a Switch owner, but I'm curious what your reaction is.
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems, considering that both the Wall Street Journal and Eurogamer have picked up this story, and there have been like rumors for like a year plus now about different Switch models in production. But I'm with you. Like, it always seemed pretty obvious that they would eventually do the Switch equivalent of what the 2DS was, which still seems to be basically what this lower version, like lower price version or whatever, is going to be, is something that's focused more on the handheld space, something that's, you know, for a younger market, so something that's like very durable. I imagine that probably, like, you know, something obvious would be like the Joy-Cons will just be like built in instead of being detachable and stuff, and like removing little like common breaking points, so it's better for a younger audience. And that always seemed like a really obvious thing for the Switch to do because of what the nature of what the Switch is, but also Nintendo's history of making and marketing products towards a younger audience. That always seemed like a really obvious move. Doing that and an updated version, like a new Nintendo Switch or Nintendo Switch Pro or whatever you want to refer to it, doing both of those simultaneously, I think, is a weird idea.
Because
one thing that's just immediately comes to me is like, what then is the normal Switch? Like, the only way I see this happening is if they phase out what is now the Nintendo Switch and replace it with the Nintendo Switch 2DS and the new Nintendo Switch. That is like, would the improved one existing at the current price point and then making a smaller or a cheaper price point for this new device. I think it's weird to think of there being three different price points that the Nintendo Switch exists at, that's like a premium version, a default version, and a lower grade version. That seems like a lot to me, particularly only like 2 years into the console's lifespan.
Exactly. And that seems like, that's what I'm thinking, is that if they are doing two, I think the current one is getting phased out. You know, there's still, it's still, the entire need for this kind of confuses me, because the Switch is selling like still so well, and I assume there's a lot of inventory out there that they'd have to figure out what to do with. But yeah, I feel like you're probably, I think the new higher end one is probably just going to go in right at that $299 price point that it's currently at, and then the other one will be a $199 price point, would make sense. But yeah, there's a lot of details in here to pick apart. The one thing about the Wall Street Journal report that does not make sense to me is they say the smaller version will have no rumble included. And
right, yeah.
And if you do that and assume there's no detachable Joy-Cons, the only problem is there are multiple first-party Nintendo games that cannot be played. Super Mario Party can only use the Joy-Cons because you have to separate them. There's a lot of mini-games that are built around rumble things or certain motion controls. And Super Mario Odyssey, one of their flagship games, has multiple moons that are all rumble-based. So they'd have to either patch those games, and for Mario Party it would be a pretty significant patch, or just have them not work with it. So that's, I don't know how that's going to work, but we can leave that to the future. I think overall, smaller, portable-only, all in one unit. Maybe you can hook it up to a dock or something, but it doesn't come in the box. I think that's what that's going to be.
Yeah, because one other thing is, I would imagine to fix that problem of like, oh, you bought this Switch, but there's stuff in Super Mario Odyssey or Super Mario Party or whatever that doesn't work. Although I think a Super Mario Party is like a more complicated one, but for like a Super Mario Odyssey, well, you can hook up, or like just like, you know, Bluetooth or whatever they use to wirelessly connect a Pro Controller or other Joy-Cons to your Switch. And
yeah.
And that's how you'd, I imagine that's how they would handle it. It's like, put that, like there's a new thing on the box that says, like, you need Rumble to do everything in this game. So if you want to do that, like, you have to have another controller.
Exactly. And then the pro one, if that's what we're calling it, is the one that confuses me. I've said this before. The Switch, the launch version that we all have, is the most polished device Nintendo's ever released. You know, the Game Boy Advance, the Game Boy Color, the original Nintendo DS, the original Nintendo 3DS all came out with really obvious glaring flaws. The Game Boy Advance didn't have a backlight. The Nintendo DS was just a weird design with the giant clamshell.
It was big and bulky.
It was big and bulky, and it was kind of dim, the backlight. The original 3DS was not bulky. It was almost, if anything, too small, and there were just a lot of obvious improvements you could make to it. It had all this glossy like texture on it, which was really hard to play with. The Switch doesn't have any of that. Like, everyone talks about how the kickstand could be better, but the kickstand is not a key thing to, like, using the Switch day-to-day, so we would all appreciate a better kickstand, but no one is going to spend $300 for a better kickstand. The way you very much would spend the $100, $200 for the Game Boy Advance SP, because that backlight was very enticing, right? I don't know what the equivalent of the backlight is. I think everyone's assuming maybe they give you a slightly bigger screen, they reduce the bezel size. But beyond that, a lot of the things I've heard just don't track with how I think of Nintendo. Like, it's not going to have 4K support. Shut the fuck up. I don't know how that would happen. The PS4 Pro can't do real 4K. I mean, for fuck's sake, what are you guys talking about? It's not going to do that. I don't think they're going to up the resolution of the base of the display on the handheld itself, because every single Switch game would have to be patched for that. Right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a 720p screen, and you have to account for that when you're making Switch games, because they already have two modes to run in, docked and handheld. You have to keep handheld consistent. I assume across all three it's going to be 720p. There's maybe they do some things like upping the clock speeds and some of the internals the way they did with the new Nintendo 3DS, but I'm not even sure about that. If they radically redesign the Joy-Con, the problem is, can you use them on the original Switch, or can you take your existing Switch Joy-Con and use them on the new one? There's just so many questions here. I almost am reluctant to talk about it, because I believe something like this is coming. There's just too many question marks to really know how to fill in the gaps.
I agree with you. Without having a clear idea of like what the direction a enhanced Switch would go in, because there's lots of different avenues of like having a higher resolution screen, removing the bezel, like, or if that's the intention, or maybe your intention is improving battery life, or maybe the intention is improving, you know, the display for its ability to, for when it's hooked up to the TV. So maybe it's something that when it's handheld, it wouldn't have many improvements, but they do something so that's like, oh, but when you put it into the dock, maybe it will be able to better support how it will look on the big screen. Like, there's so many different things you could do to the Switch to make it better in specific ways without having a clear idea of what are they looking for an improved Switch. Or is it just, It's slightly better. Like, it you know, has, you know, a slightly better processor or something. You know, it maybe is like, maybe it would be something of like the way that games run slightly better when they are hooked into the dock. Maybe it's able to kind of support that better when it's entirely portable, but you don't see much of how it's improved. And it's just that thing where you phase out what is the standard Nintendo Switch. Here's like, you know, what we would call like now like a slim version, but you don't necessarily market it that way. But something of where the PS4 Slim or the Xbox One S are better versions of those consoles. They are cheaper for the manufacturers to produce, and they also are better for the buyer or the consumer. And so if it's just something like that, and they like change how they message that, that would make sense to me. I agree with you that like the idea of the Switch Pro, that's something of like in the same way of the PS4 Pro or the Xbox One X, I don't really understand or can think of what would be the need for that, or what would that would even really look like.
It would also require Nintendo to have had a fucking brain transplant, because that's not how they've ever played this, right? Like, even with the new Nintendo 3DS, the marketing of the new Nintendo 3DS was not the higher clock speeds. It was the stabilized 3D, the improved build quality, all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, and I feel like the new Nintendo 3DS came so much later in the 3DS lifespan that, like, we're 2 years into the Switch. Like, it's too early to be doing the new Nintendo Switch move. And if you're going by, like, the way that Nintendo has traditionally treated their handhelds, I feel like it would be really soon to do that now.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I think we basically know what the smaller version is going to be, or we can predict it. I think the most likely outcome is the bigger one is, or the higher end one is really just going to be a straight replacement for the current model, the way the PS4 Slim was. They might make a couple of nips and tucks that would be nice to have, but I don't think it's going to be primarily designed for people to like trade in their current unit and buy a new one, the way like the Game Boy Advance SP was.
Yeah, because it would be interesting if that is what it is, it would be like if, you know, a year ahead of the PS4 Slim and the PS4 Pro coming out, we got a very shadowy like report that didn't have a lot of details about like Sony's making two new PS4 models. It's like, well, yeah, they are, but one of those is just a slightly better version of the PS4 that is going to replace the existing PS4. It was not that they were going to have three different existing SKUs on the market.
Right. Yeah.
So if that's what's going on here, that would make a lot of sense. There's part of me that wants it to be the there are three Switch SKUs on the market, because that would just be fucking nutso, and I want to see someone do that, because that's, I can't think of the last time or if ever someone has just been like, no, we're going to support three different versions of this console fucking right now. Like, that'd be a lot.
Yeah, because you could say, no, but they weren't. Like, I was going to say maybe Xbox One, Xbox One S, Xbox One X, there was a brief period. But by the time the X came out, the S had clearly supplanted the original and they weren't selling the launch. So
yeah, I feel like that was more just they still had a bunch of original Xbox Ones that were already manufactured. And
yeah.
So they were still selling those that they had already made, not that they were continuing to make those.
Exactly. All right. Well, we'll talk about that more later. I'm very curious to see where they're going with that. All right,
yeah.
Sean, my next news item is Borderlands 3 was announced mm-hmm. this week, thus reminding the world, oh, fuck, Borderlands is a franchise. My question, Sean, is, does the world need Borderlands 3?
I mean, based on the, like, very nothing, lackluster pitch they made, no, I don't think... As someone who didn't really played and tried to like Borderlands 1, didn't really like Borderlands 1 that much, I did play a lot of Borderlands 2, but I wouldn't say that I like really like Borderlands 2. It was just a like good game for that point where it's just like it was like a summer or something. I think I got it on sale and I played a lot of it because it was just kind of a mindless shooter that we could like a loot shooter or whatever. That was just like, oh, I can play this. And it's like, wasn't particularly great. The story was terrible. And especially like playing it basically single player, which is how I played it. It was a very, like, middling experience, but it was enough of that, like, I'm getting new loot, the numbers are going higher, I'm unlocking another skill point, I can just kind of listen to a podcast and play this thing, you know, in a world before Destiny existed. That's what Borderlands 2 was to me, but it just didn't have any of, like, any charm or anything to it, as far as, like, I was concerned. So, I am not a big Borderlands fan, but if they were trying to get someone who like has enjoyed Borderlands in some capacity and would theoretically be interested in a Borderlands 3 if they did made some sort of cool, interesting, big changes, considering it's been like 7 or 8 years since Borderlands 2, that trailer they showed did not show any of that.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I have never played a Borderlands game. I know of them through reputation. But they, if you had told me if you had shown me the trailer for Borderlands 3 and like stripped out the name, stripped out any other information, no context, and then said, Jonathan, what year did this game come out? I would have said 2012. Like, that would have been like my ballpark, like end of the 360, not end of the Xbox One PS4. And here's how I know that, Sean, because they also announced a remaster of Borderlands 1, inexplicably called the Game of the Year Edition. We'll joke about that in a minute. But I watched the trailer for both of those back-to-back. So Borderlands 3 and Borderlands 1 Game of the Year 10 years later. And I could not spot a difference. They looked identical. They sounded identical. The game, like, it was the same fucking game. I couldn't tell a difference.
Yeah. So before I move on, let's just address that. Like, I couldn't get... Because, you know, part of Borderlands is that it's supposed to have this, like, goofy sense of humor that's bad, but you know, it's supposed to, it's trying, Borderlands is trying to be funny. Borderlands isn't funny. It's not funny at all. It's excruciating. It's by far, it's the thing that makes it a really great podcast game, is that if you basically mute the fucking game and listen to something else, you cut out what is probably the worst part of the game, which is the writing of the dialogue. Because I experienced just enough of that in Borderlands 2 to know that I didn't need to experience any more. And that was the number one thing that made me not like Borderlands 1, is it was painfully fucking unfunny. but they're trying to be funny. And so I kept on thinking, like, is this deliberately supposed to be a joke? But nothing about the way they presented that trailer says to me that they're calling it the Game of the Year edition as a joke. It just seems like they couldn't come up with a... like, they didn't want to call it Definitive Edition, which is what I feel like most of these games do. Of, like, here's the up-res version with all the DLC on the newer consoles. Here's the Tomb Raider Definitive Edition. Here's the whatever. Instead of calling it that, they called it the Game of the Year edition. It's not... like, you're a bit... one, Borderlands was nobody's fucking Game of the Year in 2009. So, no. And, like, there are people who like Borderlands, but it's not fucking the best game that came out in 2009, for the love of God. And two, it ain't 2009 anymore, motherfuckers. It's 2019. It's way too late to be pushing your goddamn Game of the Year edition. Why would you name it like this?
Yeah, I feel like you can get away with Game of the Year within, like, a calendar year of when your game came out, right?
Yeah, exactly, because it should come out a couple of months after December, when people have actually given a game of the Year.
Sean.
Like, that's, to me, what would be feasible.
Here's what else came out in 2009.
Uh-huh.
Arkham Asylum, Left 4 Dead 2, Assassin's Creed 2, Uncharted 2, Dragon Age Origins, Halo 3 ODST. There were a lot of good choices for Game of the Year that year that were very, very definitely not Borderlands.
Yeah, all those games you said are significantly better than fucking Borderlands.
I just, if this is the new standard, I cannot wait for Nintendo's much anticipated release of Super Mario Brothers Game of the Year edition on the Nintendo Switch.
Fucking God, so that's really dumb, but... yeah, so putting that really dumb thing aside and whatever the fuck the reason behind that was, I'm 100% with you in the sense of, like, you know, the Borderlands 3 footage was clearly was on more advanced hardware and was designed to run on more advanced hardware. Like, it looked better in that technical sense, but nothing about the pitch, as someone who played quite a bit of Borderlands 2, nothing looked, like, distinguishable as, like, This is Borderlands 3. This, like, it looked like a game that should have come out in 2014, which would have been 2 years after Borderlands 2. Like, if they had come out with a very iterative sequel at Borderlands 2, which I guess they did. They called it the pre-sequel or whatever, so it was, like, a prequel game. So it's technically, this is the fourth Borderlands game, but nobody fucking played that pre-sequel thing. I certainly didn't, because I think it was also made by a different team. I don't know. But anyway, so, you know, if they had called that game Borderlands 3 and it had been set, you know, then the next point in the timeline and all that kind of stuff and continued the story, the rich storyline to Borderlands, then it would have made sense to me. But this feels like they designed that game to come out in 2014 and just locked it in a vault for 5 fucking years and are now trotting it out. Like, Destiny came out in that time, and Destiny 2 has got, like, the entirety of Destiny as a franchise has existed in between Borderlands 2 and now. And to me, Destiny is kind of what I had always wanted Borderlands to be since 2009, when they first pitched that game of it being like Diablo but with guns, which would be to have the shooting feel good was the number one thing I would have liked. But then also just having the guns have more of like a particular identity, instead of in Borderlands, the guns are very like... feel like it's fun in the sense of that all the guns are feel very random and you can just get something that's very ridiculous, but it feels bad in the sense of that's not always good for actual game design, that it's funny to get like a gun that has like a bunch of weird modifiers on it, but in terms of like actually designing encounters and building a game around it, when you don't have great predictability about what kinds of guns the player has, it's very hard for them to design interesting or fun encounters. Which was, I think, the problem that Destiny solved by having much more focused groups of what kinds of loot you can get, and that they could design around a lot better. So I just feel like Borderlands 3, the loot shooter, has become a very popular genre. Destiny is very successful. It seems like people are kind of liking The Division 2, even if it is a, you know, rancid game, politically speaking. But Anthem has crashed and burned. It's just very interesting to see Borderlands 3 step out into that market like none of that has happened. It'd just be like, hey guys, remember us? Like our weird, like really bad, like parody of Mad Max or whatever the fuck bullshit their game is supposed to be is in terms of the setting and the humor. It's like, hey guys, it's Borderlands. We're still doing, like, their sense of humor has not fucking evolved at all. It's like one of the things that made it feel extremely old. It's like nobody even goes for this kind of humor anymore, Borderlands. Like, it felt kind of outdated when your games were new. Now it feels like, again, it feels like this game existed in a vault and you just have trotted it out. And it's very bizarre.
I agree. Let's move on to a game I think we're both more interested in.
Yeah.
Which is, I put this on the outline specifically for you, Sean, because I thought you'd like this news. Wolfenstein Youngblood, the new Wolfenstein game from Bethesda, is coming out July 26th. And I feel like you've been very curious about what this game is. I feel like we have a good clue now, because the standard price is $29.99, so half price from a normal video game. But they're also selling a deluxe version for $40, $10 more, which has a buddy pass, which allows you to play with a friend for free, because the game is co-op. So you can have your friend download it for free, and then they can play it co-op with you if you spring for the buddy pass. But that seems to confirm that this is more like a standalone DLC than Wolfenstein 3.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like they have, since that E3, like, come out and given more clear verbiage on, like, this is not necessarily Wolfenstein 3. It's like, I'm very curious then what Wolfenstein 3 is going to be, because if people remember the pitch for Youngblood, it's set, I think in the 90s or something, it's set, like, further in the timeline where you're playing as BJ Blazkowicz's twin daughters, I believe they are. And so, obviously, that's in the future from when the games are set, if they're his daughters. So I'm curious if that means that Wolfenstein 3 will take place before this, if Wolfenstein 3 will maybe take place after Wolfenstein Youngblood. I'm curious what that's going to mean, because I feel like they've confirmed that they're working on, like, Wolfenstein 3. So yeah, I'm really curious to get a look at this game. I'm a big fan of those two Wolfenstein games, and so I'm sure that this will be very good.
Are you going to get the buddy pass so I can play it with you?
Well, because you said it allows you to play with a friend for free, but $10 more doesn't sound like free to me, buddy.
It's free for me. It's free for your buddy. It's not free for you.
I don't see how I benefit from this.
That's a good point. I feel like there's a little hole in their marketing there. You have to have charitable friends. All right. Yeah. Let's go ahead and move on. Before we get into our final segment, Sean, I have a thing on my outline that I didn't share with you, which is, because it's this little game I want you to play with me, which is, I have a challenge. This is also a news story thing. I read a news story on my Twitter timeline today about a streaming video service that was so fucking ridiculous, I had to double check like 3 times that this was not The Onion. And here's the challenge I'm going to give you. I'm going to give you the actual headline I read, and this is something that is happening in the real world. And I'm also going to give you a headline from a TV show that I know you have not seen that is satirical. And you're going to have to tell me which one is the satire and which one is reality.
Okay, and I can confirm now that I have not seen any weird news about streaming services. So I don't know what this is. I legitimately do not know.
Okay, so like I said, one of these is fake, one of these is real.
Okay.
So in no particular order. Timekeeping website whattimeisitrightnow.com gets a venture capital infusion to create its first streaming video series, a gritty private detective drama.
Okay, and what's the other one?
Sony sells majority stake in streaming service Crackle to Chicken Soup for the Soul Entertainment, the new entertainment arm of the Chicken Soup for the Soul book series.
I'm going to go with the Sony Crackle one, because Crackle exists.
You are correct.
Is that real?
Yes.
Yeah.
Chicken Soup for the Soul bought Crackle.
Fucking.
The other one is the plot of BoJack Horseman. The other one is BoJack Horseman, and it doesn't sound as ridiculous.
Chicken Soup for the... I don't understand what... So... Okay, read it for me again, now that I know that that's for sure the real one. Say it again.
Okay, so the headline was, Sony sells majority stake in streaming service Crackle to Chicken Soup for the Soul. You read a little further down, it's Chicken Soup for the Soul Entertainment, which is the new TV internet division of the Chicken Soup for the Soul book company.
Okay, so they're going to use
Crackle
to make and like to presumably now produce shows
under the banner Chicken Soup for the Soul. Yeah.
That will be like Chicken Soup for the Soul, but through your eyes instead of through like the TV stuff instead of through the book stuff.
Yeah.
I don't... How? Why? I mean, at least, like, one thing I can say is that it'll actually give Crackle a fucking identity as a streaming service, because I've never really understood what the fuck Crackle was.
Crackle is where everything else that, like, didn't demand enough of a cost for Netflix to buy it is Sony. And if Sony already owned it, they just threw it on Crackle.
Yeah. I think the only thing I've ever watched on Crackle was in, like, 2011 or something. I think I watched Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. Or one of those. One of the 90s Godzilla movies was on Crackle before I had the DVD or the Blu-ray for it, and I watched that. And that's, I'm pretty sure that's the only thing I've ever watched on Crackle. And Crackle has, aside from that, been an extreme disappointment to everybody. So this would be good for them, probably.
It's chicken soup for their soul.
Yeah, I just don't feel like I know enough about the you know, greater chicken soup for the soul media enterprise than the fact that there was a book called Chicken Soup for the Soul.
You know, we have a lot of international listeners. I don't know if that's a thing all around the world. Chicken Soup for the Soul, if you don't know, is this weird series of books where they, like, commission essays from people, and they're, like, kind of inspirational stories. I remember when I was a kid, they also had, like, because they released, like, dozens of these things, and they had ones for kids, too, so they're, like, Chicken Soup for the Elementary School Soul, and Chicken Soup for the Preteen Soul, written by, like, kids and stuff. But yeah, they're just like, if you go into a Barnes & Noble, you would see these on the shelves, so I guess. I didn't know they were still around, honestly, until I read this story. That's part of why I didn't believe it at first.
Yeah, I'm now on the Wikipedia page for Chicken Soup for the Soul, and there are, because I was going to do a joke of like, oh, I'm going to read off some of these books, but I've never before seen this on any Wikipedia page. The list of Chicken Soup for the Soul books, just the list of the books for this one, like, overall thing, has to be listed in alphabetical order by the subtitle. So Chicken Soup for the Adopted Soul is under A. There are so many of these that they are listed in alphabetical order, and I've never seen this format quite like this, because there are so many of these books. And I'm trying to scroll all the way to the bottom to see what the last one is. Okay, those are some non-English language ones. Okay, there's a bunch of T's. It doesn't look like there's a Z. There's Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul. Chicken Soup to Inspire a Woman's Soul. Chicken Soup for the Soul at Work. Chicken Soup for the Working Woman's Soul. And then there's one that's just called Life Lessons for Women, which I feel like they kind of broke the branding there. That's just a very generic...
I like Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul. Just, what is the broadest possible category we can have except for just the human soul?
Well, I'm seeing now what is one of the more specific ones, which is Chicken Soup for the Woman Golfer's Soul. So if you're in that, like, very specific demographic, if you're not just a golfer, but a woman and a golfer...
Well,
boy, have they got a fucking book for you.
I can't wait for the TV adaptation that's going to be on Crackle, about a bunch of like sassy 50s housewives who start golfing.
Yeah, man. Oh, God, there are so many. You've got Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul, Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul 2, Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul 3, Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul 4, Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul Letters, Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul Personal Organizer, September 1999 to December 2000. Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul on Love and Friendship. Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul on Tough Stuff. Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul, The Real Deal Challenges. It goes on from there.
Sean, that's literally the number scheme of the Halloween movies. You get to 4, and then you have to go the Curse of Michael Myers because you can't use numbers anymore.
Oh, this is a good one. Chicken Soup for the Soul, : Teens Talking Faith. So if you want some religious teen stories in Chicken Soup for the Soul, there's one for you.
I hope they make it their mission to, on Crackle, make a 10-episode TV series out of every one of those fucking books.
God, there's so... Chicken Soup for the Soul, O Canada, The Wonders of Winter? I don't even know what that is!
Okay, you've broken me. We have to move on.
No,
that
it's
is the funniest
John,
thing I will ever hear.
There's Chicken Soup for the NASCAR Soul. There's Chicken Soup for the Network Marketer's Soul. Oh my God, there's so many.
That can be the show about the acquisition of Crackle is chicken soup for the network marketer's soul.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that must be what it was. Someone at Crackle read one of these books. Oh my god, chicken soup for the soul. I can't believe my dog did that. Chicken soup for the soul, hooked on hockey. There are two chicken soup for the horse lover's soul. So you've got one and two for those. Oh my god. Oh my god. Chicken soup for the grandma's soul, stories to honor and celebrate the ageless love of grandmothers. Why does that one get the huge subtitle? I mean, grandmothers are pretty good, but I don't get why they just, no one else gets that massive fucking subtitle. Yeah, okay, I'm done. I can't look at these anymore. There's a lot, like, if you want to have a good time, go on Wikipedia, go to the list of Chicken Soup for the Soul books, because there's over 100 of those fucking things.
I don't even remember where this segment started. I just know I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the next time I see the words Chicken Soup for the Soul, it's going to be under the headline, Disney acquires Chicken Soup for the Soul in their next bid to take over all media, because apparently that's how big they are.
They don't have Chicken Soup for the Marvel Soul yet?
Yeah, Chicken Soup for the Jedi Soul.
Chicken Soup for the Mandalorian Soul. That's going to be the Boba Fett book.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Sean, let's talk video games. I'm still getting over that fucking list you were reading. So do you want to tell us about Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice?
Oh boy, Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice. What a fucking video game that is. So I have finished Sekiro. As I said at the beginning of this podcast, it has now been about 4 hours since I finished Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice. It's a really, really good fucking video game. It's interesting because one of the main things that people talk about around it, and for obvious reasons, is comparing it to Dark Souls. And most of the conversation I've seen around Sekiro has been trapped in that kind of in the gravity well of From Software's previous games, particularly Dark Souls and Bloodborne. And the experience of playing Sekiro as someone who is a big fan of those games is like this gradual process of having to just let go of what those games were, because I feel like this game has kind of split some of the Dark Souls fan base, of that there are people like me that really love it, and there are some people that are kind of pushed away from the game. And I think for some people, it's just like, this game is more than different enough that if you were really into the RPG element of Dark Souls and you like doing all the different character builds and playing through the game like 5 times because I want to do one as an archer and one with this like claymore giant sword and I want to do one as a magic user. Like Sekiro's just not that kind of game. So some of those people, this is just not the game for them because it's so different. But for others, I think if you are holding on too tightly to your memories of previous From Software games, you are doing Sekiro a tremendous disservice because it is just not one of those games. And for me, a big, big moment I had with Sekiro was with a boss fight that's pretty early on with a character called Lady Butterfly, who is, I think, technically an optional boss fight, but you are definitely supposed to fight her. It's like you don't have to beat her to continue the main storyline, but you really should, you know, push through if you're having difficulty with that character and finish that boss fight because it's really cool. But she was just a really challenging boss fight because she was this ninja type character. So she was very mobile. She had a lot of different ranged attacks and her poise was kind of hard to break. And so the way the game works, as a quick recap, is the sort of core of the combat system is the interplay between, the character's vitality and their poise, or I think they call it posture. Poise is what that kind of thing was in Dark Souls. So posture is sort of your stance, and if you try to block a lot, your posture meter is going to get build up, and then eventually once it gets to the max, your posture will break, which if that happens to you, that will leave you vulnerable. But if you do it to the enemy, it will leave the enemy vulnerable and to basically a finishing attack called a death blow, that most bosses kind of are designed to take multiple death blows that will kind of, once you take them out once, then it will move them to the second phase of the boss, and some bosses have like a third or a fourth phase. And so that's how the posture system works. And then you also have vitality, which is your normal health. And the main thing with vitality in terms of fighting enemies is you can both kill them by just getting their vitality all the way down. Like that is an option. But mostly it's that the higher your vitality is, the quicker your posture recharges. And so specifically for boss fights, there are some bosses for whom you really want to like just be trying to get their vitality down because their posture is too hard to break. Other bosses, you just want to not even worry about trying to like get behind them and get around their guard to deal vitality damage, because you can just, if you are really good with parries and pressing the attack, you can just break their posture with almost out doing any normal damage to them and just kill them right there if you're good enough. But then there's a boss like Lady Butterfly, for whom it is very, very difficult to get her vitality all the way down. But also, if you don't find ways to whittle away at her vitality, her posture just recharges incredibly quickly. And so for a character like that, you need to find the balance between I'm getting around behind her, doing dodges and counterattacks to try to get actual damage on her that she's not blocking. So that way, once I start doing like a lot of parries and kind of different techniques that damage her posture, that will get her to the point that her posture breaks and beat her. Which is a very different dynamic that just like doesn't exist in Dark Souls. Like that concept just simply isn't there. It's the game Neo, which I talked about a lot last year, which is a similar kind of game made by Tecmo Koei, has a similar idea with the way that enemies' stamina is exposed in that game. There's a little bit of interplay there, but even that's not quite the same as what Sekiro does. And so I was just having the hardest fucking time with that Lady Butterfly fight until eventually this thing clicked all of a sudden that I had realized I'd been drastically holding myself back the entire time I had been playing the game, because I kept on playing Sekiro like it had a stamina bar the way that Dark Souls or Bloodborne have a stamina bar. For those games, like the entire thing about Dark Souls is you're just constantly managing your stamina, because your stamina determines how many attacks you can do in a row, how many rolls you can do or like dodges you can do, how many hits you can block, and it also determines how long you can sprint or jump for. And so managing your stamina is kind of the entire mechanic of how Dark Souls works from a certain perspective, particularly for the very like agile builds I like to play in those games. And so I realized all of a sudden that it's like, oh, I have no stamina. In Sekiro, if you want to, you can just sprint forever. You never have to stop sprinting. And the Lady Butterfly fight takes place in this big open room. And I realized like, Why am I ever just standing here? You should constantly be mobile and constantly dodging around. And like in for that fight in particular, if you're just running all over the place like a madman, because you are very, very quick, like the sprint is incredibly fast in Sekiro, you're able to dodge a lot of her attacks, you're able to avoid all of her ranged attacks, you can just run around. And it was this moment of like, I have been completely holding myself back the entire time I've been playing this game, because I've just been thinking of it like it's Dark Souls. And watching a lot of videos of other people playing this game, you can definitely see that there are some people that get it and it clicks for. And there are some people that are so held back, like I was early on, by the memory of how you play the combat and of the other From Software games, that you just never even play Sekiro like it is its own game. And it's interesting because I've never encountered that before. I've ever played a like game by a developer and been so attached to the games that the developer had previously made, because they like those Dark Souls and Bloodborne games have such a strong, specific, unique identity. There's only a couple of games like Neo that even tried to do something similar to what those games do, that you're so attached to it that it's holding you back from accepting what this new game is. And that moment when that clicked for me, like the whole game opened up, and Sekiro is now like, it's so different from Dark Souls. And any time I felt myself like having a lot of difficulty with the game, it was usually because it's like, oh, I'm treating this fight like it's a Dark Souls fight. Like, I can go into stealth. You can stealth things. You can sneak around in this game. I played the first like 3 or 4 hours not sneaking around fucking anything. And by the time I got to the end of the game, at the end of the game, you have an opportunity to kind of go back to some of the early areas that have like new enemies that populated them because of story stuff. And so I was going back through some of the first areas in the game, remembering areas that I had so much trouble with. And I looked at it with like now like 30 hours of playing this game experience under my belt, and looking at these, it's like there are literally a dozen different ways I could have just snuck around and treated this like a stealth encounter. And instead I just ran at it like front on like a fucking moron. It's like, nope, there's like grass over here. There's a little sneaky path you can do over here. There's a grapple point up here. It's like I could have literally just avoided this entire thing through stealth if I wanted, or taken the entire encounter as like a stealth combat exercise, which is clearly what the intention was. And I would just refuse to see it. In a way that I imagine if you played Sekiro with no experience of other From Software games, you would not have that problem at all. So that was like one of the first really interesting experiences I had with this game, that like having to relearn and re-understand what this game was, because I had so many preconceptions going into it. And it's something that it'll be interesting to see how that shapes the conversation around this game and how many people are able to let go of their biases from the previous From Software games and treat Sekiro as its own thing, or if it's going to be constantly held back by its endless comparisons to games that honestly is really not that similar to.
Weirdly, I feel like I might have a similar entree into Yoshi's Crafted World in terms of how I'm looking at it.
Interesting.
Because maybe we can go back and forth here, and if you have more to say on Sekiro, you can say it when I'm done here. But I'm actually kind of curious about this because, you know, Yoshi's Crafted World is getting really rave reviews from some people, and it's getting more, you know, middling reviews from others. And one of the like differences I've seen there is some people saying, like, really focusing on, oh, it's such a beautiful, dense game. There's so much to kind of explore and find and all this stuff. And other people saying, yeah, but it's just too easy. And I've seen that a lot with Yoshi's Crafted World. Is it's just, you know, it's like, you know, some of these other recent Nintendo games like Yoshi's Woolly World or Kirby Star Allies. There's just, you don't die enough. It's too easy. And my reaction to that is kind of, it says on the tin, it's Yoshi. Like, what were you expecting? Like, did you go to a Care Bears movie and walk out because there wasn't enough graphic sex and violence? Like, what are you talking about? Yoshi has never been that hard. And I thought about it, and that's mostly true. The original Yoshi's Island, which is, I think, one of the best platformers ever made, does have some definite challenge to it. It has the whole mechanic of Baby Mario, who can fall off, and you have the time meter. And so there is there's some really grueling levels in Yoshi's Island. But in general, I think these are more mellow games. But even by that standard, Yoshi's Crafted World, there are many things I want to say about it, because I think it's a really kind of extraordinary game. I'm really loving it. I think it's one of the most interesting platformers I've seen from Nintendo in a while, and a lot of the recent ones have been very good, but this one's a cut above a lot of the side-scrolling stuff, I think. And part of it for me is that it's not quite the game I was expecting, because it looks like its own thing because it's all the crafted stuff. But in terms of the basic like controls and mechanics, it looks like Yoshi's Island. It is Yoshi. He's got the flutter jump. He swallows enemies and makes eggs. You press the X button and he throws the eggs. All of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The biggest change in controls is that for the first time, you decide where you send the egg. In the other games, it always just the egg went in this like arc and you had to wait until the point where you wanted to send it and then you hit X again. In this game, you use the control stick and you can send it wherever you want it. But even if it looks like Yoshi's Island and it's, you know, it's laid out, there's a world map, there's levels, you go into the levels, so it looks like a pretty standard Nintendo platformer. When you get into the levels, the way it feels to me is not like a lot of other Nintendo platformers of the last 10 years. It is so much less focused on the basic like movement challenges, I would almost call it, for a platformer, of like getting through obstacles, getting through enemies. It really is about, the game has a list of objectives that you do to like fulfill and get everything. And there's certain ones that never change, like get 100 coins in this level and finish with full health or finish with all 20 red coins. Those three are always there. And then there's always a series of yellow flowers to find in the levels. So those are always kind of your big objectives. But each level takes a pretty creative approach to what you do in that level, even if you're moving linearly through it, to find all of those things. And they all have their own characteristics, and sometimes they have their own mechanics to master. Like, there's ones where you're in a giant Yoshi robot that goes through and fights, and sometimes you're in a on a plane and you have to do things like that. So it's very creative in that sense. But for me, the joy of Yoshi's Crafted World is not the challenge of, like, getting through the level and dying a lot. And the game is very aware of that, because it doesn't have a life system. It doesn't have any kind of continues. It, when you die, it just says game over, but would you like to try from the checkpoint, right? So it's dispensed with all that kind of fluff. And really the challenge is, if you can, you know, kind of master the sense of how the game is laid out, so you can find all the things hidden in the world, you can figure out all the... And you start to get this sixth sense, which I really like with some Nintendo games that do this, or any kind of platformer that hides stuff. You get this sixth sense for where you feel like they're going to be hiding things from you, and adapting that to the different themes and gameplay gimmicks they throw at you. And I actually find a lot of Yoshi's Crafted World very challenging in the sense of, like, shit, I have a lot to worry about right now to do all of these different things, and figuring out the way, it's challenging in a very low-key way, but that challenge of getting through this level and doing all the things I want to do so I can 100% it, it usually requires doing the level a couple of times, but I find it pretty creative and invigorating. And I guess just what you were saying about Sekiro resonated with me on that sense of, like, because I tend to hear these complaints about any Nintendo platformer that is not Mario or Donkey Kong, is people going, like, oh, they're not hard. Like, they're for kids. Like, you can't die, so what's the point? And for me, it's like, well, for one, there's more to games than that to begin with. But also, like, why these games are good and they keep, you know, making new Yoshi and Kirby games is I feel like their pleasures lie in kind of a different place than that. And Yoshi's Crafted World is better than any of the recent Yoshi or Kirby games, specifically in how well it tackles that idea of it's going to look on the surface like a platformer, you know, but I think the specific way you're going to go in and tackle it and the real focus on the slow density of levels you explore, not the kind of fast-paced get through the levels. I'm having a lot of fun with it, and it feels very different than a lot of other, you know, non-Mario, non-Donkey... Not Donkey Kong doesn't get a lot of games anymore, but when he does, non-Donkey Kong games. And it's really good in that sense, but I do feel like there is this weird standard that kind of exists for what a this kind of platformer should be. And I feel like Yoshi's Crafted World is getting a pretty good reception, but I feel like that is the main thing it's fighting. I don't think it's anything in the quality of the game itself.
Well, if you want to talk about difficult video games and games that are very hard, holy fucking shit, Sekiro's pretty fucking tough. Nothing in the game hits the level of there's an optional boss in Dark Souls 3 that's like this thunder dragon motherfucker that is just excruciatingly brutally difficult. That is probably the hardest boss I've ever beaten in any game still is that optional boss in Dark Souls 3. Sekiro does also have an optional boss at the end that I did beat. And he's very fun because he's like, it basically feels like they just said, what if we just put a Bloodborne boss in this game? Like, what if we just took a bot? Like, it's almost literally like some of the attacks are like, I forget what the boss is called, but it's the boss you fight that's like the lady that transforms inside of the church in, or it's like one of the earlier bosses in Bloodborne. It's like a very similar kind of boss fight. It's just like, fuck it. Like, we've generally had you fighting like normal people with swords and spears and shit. What if you fought a giant monster and like, and we just made it a Bloodborne thing? And that's kind of, so that boss is pretty difficult, but nothing Sekiro's like the hardest thing I've done in the game, but there is a consistent level of like, this game is gonna fucking put the screws to you. But there's something about the way that it handles that difficulty that I think is way more honest than anything in From's previous games and in like most games that are very hard. Like a good example is actually to go back to Demon's Souls, which I have never finished, but the first of any of these From Software games I played was Demon's Souls. I just never got very far into it, which was the very, very first one that was on PS3.
I think I still have that on my PS3 because you played it back in the day.
Yes, because it was a PS Plus game, and so I played it. So yeah, my save that's in like the, I forget what the it's like the castle area or whatever in Demon's Souls, because Demon's Souls has this weird like almost Mega Man-y kind of thing where you teleport to like five different areas that are totally disconnected. So I was stuck in that area. And one of the main reasons I stopped playing Demon's Souls was I had been fed all this stuff about like how the game's really hard, but they were always very fair, which I think is mostly true of those games, but it's not always true. And those games are definitely designed in a way that you're going to run into things that are supposed to kill you the first time, and not even just a boss. The specific example I have for Demon's Souls is there's an area where you are like running on a bridge, and it just seems like you're on a normal bridge, this is fine, and then all of a sudden a dragon flies in from nowhere, shoots fiery breath at the bridge, and if you don't know what's going on and you think, is this a new boss fight, like what's going on, like me, you just get murdered immediately, because this is like 3 hours into the game. I didn't know the game that well, and I was doing pretty good up to that point, and was good. Then it kind of acclimated to the combat system in that game pretty quickly. And I got killed by that dragon, and I had a bunch of souls, because if you don't, you know, remember or don't know, the way that those games work is that as you kill enemies, you get souls, which you use to level up. But if you die, you drop your souls, and you have to then go get those souls again. And if you don't, if you die before you recover them, they're gone forever. And so I had a bunch of souls that would have been a big level up for me that was on that bridge, and I tried to make my way over there. And I think I don't think the dragon killed me again. I think something else killed me along the way because I was kind of so flustered. But I lost all the souls and got really upset with the game because I felt like I had died due to something that was in no way my own fault, and then lost like considerable progress and like the progress of my character because I lost all those souls. Like later, like in Dark Souls, you come to learn if you play enough of those games that those kinds of losses are not that big of a deal, but it feels like a big deal the first time it happens to you. So I kind of quit the game and didn't come back to it until a couple years later I started Dark Souls, and now here I am playing all these fucking games. But those games, like that's a specific example, but generally across those games, there are lots of examples like that of little things, like traps in dumb little like areas that are like basically, if they don't kill you the first time you encounter them, it's basically just because you are lucky, not because you were good at the game. Sekiro has almost nothing like that. In fact, I can't, off the top of my head, think of anything that is exactly like... There's maybe one thing that's a little bit dumb, but even that's, like, really late into the game, and you should know the mechanics well enough to be able to deal with it. So there's only kind of one thing that's sort of like that dragon sort of thing in Demon's Souls. And that's true across all of Sekiro, is that the difficulty is considerable, and it is a hard game that is very demanding of you. But because there's no like weird wiggle room, it's not something that like you can't beat this person because you don't have enough health. It's not that you can't beat this person because you don't do enough damage or you don't have the right weapon, because if the areas where you do need a shinobi tool, which are your sort of like alternate attacks you can get that you unlock that you use with R2, like those are all given to you and are like explicitly kind of signposted, like this is a character that you're supposed to use the spear because the spear rips off the armor of big armored enemies. So it's like they like tell you, like they literally, like a character will say that and you will encounter the spear before you fight the big dude that has the big armor that you have to rip off of the spear. So it's never something where it's like you just don't have the right weapon, or your weapon's not leveled up enough, or you didn't get enough of like your dexterity stat to get like the boost of the damage, and like the very arcane systems that the other like Souls type games have, because they're like very heavy stat heavy RPGs. Sekiro is much more like a Ninja Gaiden or something like that, where I guess those games do tend to have multiple weapons, whereas Sekiro, you just have the sword. Like, you have this sword, Kasabimaru, and that's the sword you have. It's like weird, like non-spoiler, that's the sword you have for the entire game. You never get a different sword. You never get a different kind of attack that goes on R1. All that is the same throughout the entire game. The upgrades and those things in other ways your character improves are delivered through like designed story moments or like specific progression that you get from beating the bosses. And so there's just no situation in which you encounter a fight that you are actually unprepared for, which is something that can 100% happen in the other games in this franchise. And so it ends up feeling more like kind of like what we were talking about Rondo of Blood, where it's like, it's hard, yeah, but there's no question that you are able to do this. Like, you should be able to clear it. You just have to find the path. You need to be able to read the boss's attacks. You need to figure out like your timing with the windows and all that kind of stuff. Like, you can always clear whatever encounter you are facing. And there's something about that where Sekiro feels like this tremendously honest game that's like upfront about like, this is what it is. It's going to be hard. But I found myself being able to acclimate to that difficulty. And I never encountered something in Sekiro that really, truly frustrated me. There's like one little thing with the way that there's like maybe an extra phase on the last boss, the last boss in the game that I kind of wish wasn't there, but it's not really like, it's not something that actually made it that much harder. And so that's something about Sekiro that I really love, is that it feels like it is designed, because it is, like an action game. And it has this approach that if you are fond of something like a Ninja Gaiden, the like Xbox Ninja Gaiden, the 3D one, and or something even like Rondo of Blood, you know, like taking like the liberties with how different the games are in terms of how they control, it has that approach to difficulty feels much more square in a way that like the Dark Souls games, those games in comparison are a little bit fuzzy. Sekiro is like incredibly precise with everything it does, and that's one of my favorite things about it, is that once you get accustomed to how to play the game and get good at it, you... Like, I feel really good at Sekiro now. Like, I feel like I have learned so much about how to play that game. And if I did a new game plus, I feel like I would be able to blow through that game super quickly, because everything about the way I played it the first time should be able to work the second time. And I just, and even if the numbers are not in my favor, because I know new game plus is technically harder and like enemies have more health and that kind of stuff, like if I employ the same strategies and play with the same like level of acumen, I should be able to accomplish all the challenges again. And there's something really satisfying about that directness and that sort of relative linearity that Sekiro has in terms of its encounter design. That is something that like a big broad game that has like dozens of different weapons and all these different like magic spells and all the stuff that Dark Souls has, those games just don't have. They are imprecise in comparison by design.
See, everything you're saying, I really want to play this now. This sounds like something I'd really enjoy. I don't think I'll get to it till like maybe May or June, like more of a downtime for video games and life. But because April's going to be busy on both counts. But like, I really want to play this. Like, Rondo of Blood made me think like, okay, if I can beat this fucking game, I could beat Sekiro. And because what you're describing, that's how I felt at the end of Rondo of Blood, was like, you know, it took me a while to get through it the first time, but especially if I used Maria, I could blow through that game in probably like an hour, you know, knowing how everything falls down, and that's fun. You know what this made me think of, jumping back to Yoshi? Nobody else is doing this podcast, by the way, where we are blending a review of Yoshi's Crafted World and Sekiro Shadows Die Twice. This is Weekly Stuff exclusives, guys.
This is one of the more Weekly Stuff podcast episodes we've done in a while. It's very distinctly us.
But, you know, I think there are transferable lessons here, because I think one of the things you're saying there is that Sekiro is really good at knowing what it is, right?
Yes,
and incentivizing
absolutely.
You to play it the way it wants you to play it. That's something I really like about Yoshi's Crafted World. I think there is a clarity to what that game is doing that I like. So, in comparison, I've been playing, since it came out in January, New Super Mario Bros. U, the re-release they did on Nintendo Switch. That is a really good game. I decided to give it a second chance because there is a contingent of the internet that insists that is one of the best Mario games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had never really felt that, but I thought, I should give it a try. So, I beat the game. I really enjoyed the game. I didn't think it was a great Mario game, but I thought it was an above-average one. It was very good in a lot of ways. I played a lot of it with my brother in co-op when we were in Colorado together before he left for Japan, and I enjoyed it. Then I finished it. I still was kind of between games, and I would go back to it, you know, every couple of days just when I needed to, like, listen to a podcast and relax, and I was trying to get more of the coins in the game. So the in New Super Mario Bros. Has, every level has three big gold coins hidden in it, and those are the main collectibles, and if you find all the gold coins, then you can unlock some new levels and things like that. And I realized, this game is so much more fun when I try to get everything. Like, the levels feel so much more interestingly designed when I go for the three coins. And I'm like, well, Jonathan, you knew that. You've played every New Super Mario Bros. Game. You played Super Mario 3D Land and loved it so much you 100%ed it, and it has the same three gold coin thing. Why didn't that occur to you? And I think that's because the basic design of New Super Mario Bros. Is that it's an additive thing. Like, there's the main levels, and I do think they're designed with the coins in mind, but you can beat the whole game without ever thinking about them. Right? Like, that's just not really a consideration. They're not clearly signposted, I feel like, in the UI. You have to kind of know, like, the game is better if you make yourself find them in every level. Yoshi's Crafted World feels like it is built with that idea in mind, where the point of the levels is not so much the getting from A to B, it is the finding the stuff along the way, and looking around every nook and cranny, and because the visual design, which I'll talk about in a minute, is so cool and interesting and thoughtful and creative, it's really a joy to look around every nook and cranny. And the game really clearly signposts it by giving you the list of objectives, having that very clearly laid out for you in the menus of what do you have, what don't you have. It's very easy to know what you have found and what you haven't. And progression is gated by how many of the collectible flowers you have. Now, you don't need all the flowers to get through. It's a pretty low amount. But it's at least there to remind you that it's a part of it. So I'm having, like, the fun I was having at the end of New Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe at the beginning of Yoshi's Crafted World, because the game just signals, and I think as a game is built so well to just encompass that and decide, this is our play style, this is the kind of game we're making, and that's how you should play it. And I think that clarity is really good, because I definitely think this is a better game than New Super Mario Bros. U. I would say it's probably a better game than, you know, Kirby Star Allies last year, or even something I loved like Kirby Planet Robobot on 3DS a couple years ago, better than Yoshi's Woolly World. And I think part of it is just that I feel like the visuals are just so spectacular, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but I also think the game has a sense of gameplay identity that some of those other ones, they can be really, really good at what they're doing, but I don't know if that identity is quite as solid.
Yeah, that makes sense. That is how I feel about Sekiro. And it's like, it's the same thing of where, like, I think it's one of the reasons why I like Bloodborne more than Dark Souls, is that, like, Bloodborne is now, like, in this weird middle point between Sekiro and Dark Souls, that, like, that game is much more focused, and there's not, like, you don't have, like, full magic builds you can do in that. There's, you know, the gun in that game is not so you can be an archer and, like, fight from a distance. It's there for parries, and so, like, the game is designed around a very focused playstyle, and Sekiro refines that even more. And as you said with, like, Yoshi, this is this ability for the game to communicate, like, this is what this game is. And, like, maybe that means that some people will not like it, because it's like, if you are not into the action in Sekiro, there is nothing else in that game for you. But if you are there for what the game is offering to you, you are going to fucking love it.
Yeah, and same with Yoshi. If you are there for this kind of game of, like, I just want to do A, B through the levels, I never want to play a level a second time, I don't want to ever have to backtrack, it's not going to be for you. It is a game that is best enjoyed, taken slowly, expecting that you're going to do pretty much every level at least twice, because there's also the backwards one run through the levels where they flip the level around, and that, you know, you're not just going to do a mad dash to the end. There's even things like the game is, after the first couple levels, it's just a completely open map and you can kind of go wherever you want. So, like, I feel like it signals that pretty well. But I've definitely heard frustration about that. And it's like, fine, there's a Mario game out they just put out that is basically what it sounds like you want. And that's great. It's good that, like, same with Dark Souls. Like, luckily, From Software has made enough games that whatever flavor of difficult action fantasy game you want, they've probably made it for you.
Exactly, yeah. So moving on to a new point that maybe this will help segue for you to talk about the visuals for Yoshi. One of my favorite things about Sekiro, this is another thing that I think has split some of the Dark Souls community, is I adore the setting. And that's obviously, like, you know, you listen to this podcast, you know, you said something in, like, Samurai period Japan. This is, like, sort of Sengoku era Japan. I am fucking here for that shit, and I feel so blessed that all of a sudden we're getting all these goddamn samurai games. We had Neo last year, we're getting Neo 2 either this year or next year, I forget when. We have now Sekiro, and we have Ghost of Tsushima for Sony for whenever that's going to come out on the PS4, and it's just like, we went so long with having no goddamn samurai games, and now we have a shit ton of them. Even the Sekiro is technically a shinobi game, but still basically a samurai game.
You know what's amazing to me, Sean, is that for the entire life of the Assassin's Creed series, everyone has been saying, make a samurai game, make a ninja game, something like that, Assassin's Creed. And in the time it took them to continue ignoring that, an entire subgenre of samurai games has risen and just completely made that would be completely redundant now if Assassin's Creed did get off its ass and do that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm with you that it just, like, doesn't even feel like you didn't... Like, I would still be down for it, because I'll be down for any samurai thing. So if you want to do Assassin's Creed Japan, fucking do that. I will play that one. But I don't need it in the way that, like, for years. Like, I was one of those people of, like, what the fuck? Set it, like, oh my god, set it in Meiji-era Japan, which is when they, like, lowered the borders and let, like, everybody, like, the Western influence come in. And it was, like, samurai were kind of outlawed and, like, guns, there were, like, a bunch of guns coming into Japan. It's like, oh my god, it's such a perfect period to set Assassin's Creed. Fucking just do it, you idiots. They still haven't done it. I have not started playing it yet for obvious reasons, because I'm playing Sekiro and stuff, but I did on sale pick up the Japanese version of Yakuza Ishin, or I technically guess Ryuga Gotoku Ishin, since it never came over here, so I guess it's not really Yakuza. But it's the Yakuza game that is set in Meiji-era Japan.
Nice.
So at some point, it came out, like, only in Japan at the launch of the PS4. It went on sale. I've been, like, waiting for that to go on sale in Japanese, because Japanese video games are fucking expensive, so I have that so I can play it fucking whenever.
Does that game have a mini game where you do a traditional style back tattoo on someone and you have to, like, put the bamboo needle into, like, every pore?
I don't know what mini games it has, but there's a chance that that's one of them. Who knows?
It'd be pretty good.
And it's like, you do it, but you do it on the back of some, like, Yakuza boss as he's, like, talking to his, like, me, like, all his henchmen are there, and he's talking about how they have to go kill Zatoichi or something, and yeah, you're there, and he's like, ah, god damn it! He's like, ah, we gotta get that damn Ichi. They should make a Zatoichi video game. That's never gonna happen, but it should happen. Anyways, back to Sekiro. As is obviously clear, I really like samurai stuff. And so the Sekiro setting is so effective for me, in a way that, like, Dark Souls I've never really cared that much about. There are lots of examples of Western fantasy stuff I really like Lord of the Rings or The Witcher, but Western fantasy as a genre, as a whole, is not a thing that, like, holds specific powerful appeal to me. Like, You know, I'm not going to play a game or watch a movie or like go out of my way for something specifically just because it's Western fantasy. I will only go to it if it's a really good example of Western fantasy.
Most Western fantasy is pretty dumb and boring.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it, and this is like a thing I felt since I was like 13 or something, and all of a sudden realized that like 90% of the young adult fantasy books I was reading was utter fucking garbage, including Harry Potter. Which I guess is Western fantasy in a different way, but you know, I had that moment. I was like, this is kind of dumb, and I actually don't like this that much. I only like the really good examples of the genre. It's kind of like I'm with that with like horror also. If you have a really good example of horror, I will fucking love it. But trash horror, it does nothing for me. Trash samurai movie, I am there for. I don't give a shit. Like, it can be the best samurai movie ever, like Katakiri, or it can just be like basic, like dumb garbage. And like, you know, there's a couple of none of the Zatoichi movies are garbage, but there's something like Zatoichi and the Chest of Gold that's like a middling movie. I would watch that movie ahead of like much better movies anytime, just because it's like samurai stuff and Zatoichi and it's cool and I like that setting. And so that's the same way with like Bloodborne. If you have weird, cool Victorian horror stuff, I'm fucking there for it. Like, particularly like if you mix Lovecraftian, like that setting was really powerful for me. But normal Dark Souls and that kind of thing just doesn't hold a lot of appeal. So I think there are some people that I've seen complain that they just think that like the Sekiro setting is a little bit too bland and they like want the more sort of fantastical thing. For me, the Sekiro setting is just fucking awesome because it's set in Sengoku era Japan, but it's like a fictionalized version of it. So the Ashina clan, which is sort of the clan that all the story revolves around, is a fictionalized clan. It didn't actually exist. And so they have kind of full free reign to do whatever they want. You're not like encountering like Nobunaga Oda or like Tokugawa or any of the actual historical figures of the period, like the way that like Neo was set in the same period, but you were encountering historical people involving yourself in like historical events. This is like, it sort of takes the aesthetic of that period. You get the sense of like, this is when there are lots of samurai around. The central ruling power of Japan with the emperor is incredibly weak. And so it's a time of incredible war and strife within the country. And Ashina as a clan, as the game is beginning, is starting to fall apart. And you are sort of trying to figure out what's going on. Why is this happening? But there is also like a supernatural element to the setting, which I think is really effective and how it's very lightly deployed and it gets a little bit stronger the closer you get to the end, which is your main character, Okami or Wolf, who is a shinobi, is tasked with serving and protecting this young lord named Kudo, who is this like priest who has inherited what they call like the divine dragon blood, which is this like special blood, something that allows people to become immortal. And you find out that at some point before the beginning of the game, this is where you do like this whole like memory thing, you discover that Wolf is immortal because he received that blood from his master when he died in this like tragic event that happened years ago in the fight with Lady Butterfly. This is an early thing. I feel fine with spoiling it. You like Sekiro dies at the end of that fight and Kudo bestows his blood onto him. So you become immortal. And that's kind of how they get around the like, you know, narrativize the resurrection kind of stuff. That is a big theme that From likes to do in all their games, whether it's Dark Souls, Bloodborne. They still like to do that here. So you get that hint of like supernatural stuff early on. And then throughout the game, you get these little sprinklings of like, every once in a while you will encounter a creature that's like not quite human. That's a little bit like bizarre or grotesque or peculiar. And again, as you get deeper into the game, that like that element grows stronger and stronger. And there's something about that to me that is incredibly effective, because it's not just like there's magic bullshit going on all the time. So particularly in the earlier parts of the game, when you do encounter something that is like clearly supernatural and like inhuman, it's really effective and it's kind of shocking because you're just not expecting it. You're not expecting to encounter a monster out of nowhere when you've spent like the last 5 hours just fighting dudes with swords and spears. So that element of the game I love is that like the supernatural stuff is there, but it's light. The other element of that is fucking amazing, that is so good and makes the boss fights in Sekiro my favorite boss fights in any of these games, is that since giant monsters and like weird creatures are very rare in the setting of Sekiro, that means most of the boss fights you have are just fights with other dudes that have swords, which are always the best boss fights in any game. Yes. Like this, it's also one of the reasons why Yakuza has the best boss fights in like any franchise, is because they don't have any excuse. Like, you can't have a giant monster in Yakuza. You can only have two dudes with giant dragon back tattoos rip their fucking shirts off and punch each other in the face, right? And so that's just awesome and that's super cool. Especially if you have the game mechanics to kind of back it up. Sekiro has the same kind of quality. It's not the like cartoonishly over the top the way the Yakuza games can get, but you know, the last battle you had, like the last boss in the game, like I feel comfortable saying this because it should be, this is not a spoiler, this should be something that entices people, is not a boss fight where you're like hacking at the shins of some giant dragon monster or whatever the way it is in most of these games. It's like, no, you're standing in a field full of reeds on a cloudy night with another dude that just has a fucking sword. And you just fight each other with swords. And as the boss fight moves through phases, it goes from a cloudy night to a stormy night. And like lightning starts shooting in the fucking clouds. And it's the most epic fucking shit. And it's so much cooler than just hacking away at the feet of some giant monster that you're rolling around as it does big sweeping attacks. There are a couple of boss fights that do some of those kinds of mechanics, if you like that a lot in Dark Souls. But by far, the vast majority of major encounters in the game are just cool duels with other cool samurai dudes. And that's what I'm fucking here for. And while the visual aesthetic of the game is not something that is like the most technically advanced thing in the world, as is true of all the other From Software games, the artistic aesthetic behind it and being able to present that very cinematic samurai fantasy of standing in a blowing field of reeds while you like slowly draw your sword and this other dope dude slowly draws his sword and says, "Mairu Sekiro!" And then you like clash your swords. It's fucking awesome. And it's way cooler than any of these other games.
That sounds so good.
It's so good, Jonathan. And it's one of the things that I think would get you into the game that, in a way that the Dark Souls stuff would not. Because when the cool shit happens, it's cool on a different level.
Yes.
That those games can't approach.
I mean, you're describing the squaring off in a field of reeds. And I'm like, if that were the box art, I'd already own this thing. I mean, that's fucking great.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's exactly what it needs to be. So aesthetically, Yoshi's Crafted World is abso-fucking-lutely stunning. Like, legitimately the most kind of mind-boggling visual achievement I've seen in a game in a while. Maybe since, I guess, the last one that probably, like, actively blew my mind of how are they doing this was God of War. Now, God of War is one that's blowing my mind on two levels. It's the single-take thing, and it's also just the sheer visual fidelity. Yoshi's Crafted World, it's running on Switch. It's not, you know, breaking new ground technically necessarily, but it's just how they're using the tools at their disposal where the game is, the theme is, it's all made out of crafted materials. This game was developed by a Nintendo subsidiary called Feel Good Games, or Good, I think it's Good Feel Games. I always I don't know. I think
Mix that up.
I just had a stroke live on the podcast. So there you go.
You always mix that up. I will help you out.
Mix that up. And but Good Feel started working with Nintendo in the Wii days. They made a Wario Land game, Wario Land Shake It. I've never played that one, although I hear it's good. But then they did Kirby's Epic Yarn, and that's when they started doing all the yarn stuff. So they did Kirby's Epic Yarn. They did Yoshi's Woolly World. And all of those games are beautiful. Like, I talked about Yoshi's Woolly World at the time, and that game is very impressive of how it looks like just real photorealistic wool. But Yoshi's Crafted World is on another level, where it's all arts and crafts supplies. So it's cardboard and construction paper and tissues and aluminum foil and coat hangers and markers and all this other stuff. And every level is constructed like that. And it really does look like they just physically built every inch of every one of these levels and then either just photographed it into the game or very clearly modeled it on that, because there is a... Even if it had none of the good gameplay stuff I've talked about, this game would be a joy to just look at and look at how it is built, because it's one of the only games where you really actively think about every single piece of the mise-en-scene, because it is all functional and it's all coming from somewhere. And, you know, one of the moments I had early on where I realized, oh God, they really put a lot of thought into this, is there's a front layer in one of the levels that's like little waterfalls falling down, and I realized, oh, that's a little translucent ribbon that is spinning around on a wheel and coming down like that, and that's how they're doing a waterfall. Or like in a volcano level, the volcano in the background that's like spewing fire is a cardboard thing with a tissue sticking out, and there's a little fan blowing it up, and there's like an orange light on it. And they've just thought about every inch of that. But they've also made the game really hyper three-dimensional. So everything is happening on multiple axes. You generally move left to right as Yoshi, although you do move between the layers a lot. But they use some very active you know, rendering, like focus, you know, I don't know what you call that in video games. I was going to say like focus pulling, which would be a cinematic thing, but like depth of field, I guess is what you would call it. And to really focus you on what layers you're looking at. But the way they do it makes it look hyper three-dimensional. Like, you know, I've played a lot of 3DS games that are very immersive. I've seen some 3D movies that are very immersive. The illusion of Yoshi's Crafted World, where I'm playing the game and I'm forgetting that I'm looking at a 2D image because it looks like someone has just built a diorama and I'm playing it on my TV and I could swear to God that is an actual 3D image in front of me, it's really surreal. And I think it's a mix of the game runs at a rock-solid 60 FPS, so that alone gives it more of a sense of texture and dimensionality. And then just the quality of the graphics, how immediate and real things look as crafted materials, how well thought out everything is, and how much that layering effect is also used in the gameplay. It's really incredible. I think I said this after the demo, it would not surprise me if this game was pitched at some point as a 3DS game because it is so 3D dependent, but the way they've realized it on Switch is really next level stuff. And the amount of themes they throw at you already in the game, you know, I've played maybe a third of the game overall, is really crazy. You know, you go through forests and you go through volcanoes and you fly in the air and you go through fields and you know, sometimes there's some really unexpected themes they go for, and it's just really cool, all of it. They never do the same level twice. It never feels like they're repeating an idea. You know, they'll, but at the same time, if they do a cool level gimmick, that level will really wring the most out of that gimmick and feel like you got your worth out of that big idea. And it's really neat. Like, I would really encourage anyone who's interested to just watch some videos of the game in action. Hopefully the videos are captured in actual, you know, 60 frames per second, because I do think that's part of it. But it's a really interesting technical achievement. And this is, I believe, the first-party Nintendo game that's an Unreal Engine game, because this was made in Unreal Engine. There have been other prominent Switch games made in Unreal Engine. Mario plus Rabbids was done that way. That's Ubisoft, and then Square Enix did it for Octopath Traveler. And what we're learning from all that, because I've also watched some of the like Digital Foundry breakdowns of these games, is I guess Unreal Engine is really good for these kind of games where you're using some kind of alternate aesthetic, because it allows you to do cool things with textures. So like the way they did it in Octopath Traveler is everything was just modeled with 3D polygons, and then all of the 16-bit stuff is just textures on top of that. I assume something similar is going on in Yoshi's Crafted World, but the Eurogamer piece on that, it was pretty actually technically complicated what they're doing. Like, it sounds like Crafted World isn't even running at a full 1080p on the TV. It's like 720, but you would never know looking at it. It is so clear. And it is another reminder that, you know, pixel counts and the power under the hood so is not everything to gaming. Like, because what they're pulling out of the technology in the Switch and what's in the Unreal Engine for this game is just, it's magic. It really is one of the most visually stunning games I've ever looked at. And it is so core to the experience of the game, because it really feels like they've taken that and made that cool aesthetic project that the game is. A lot of how you play it is about engaging with that aesthetic product. Like, things are going to capture your attention in the background and you're going to send an egg flying back and you might uncover a secret, and you get to know that as you go through the game. It's just really delightful to look at. And all the Yoshi games over the years have looked good. Yoshi's Island on SNES is one of the best looking Super NES games, and it's got that kind of crayon aesthetic, and Yoshi's Story on N64 does something like that. There's Yoshi's Woolly World. But this one is a step up, and overall, as a complete package, this is easily the best Yoshi game since Yoshi's Island on the Super NES, and there have been a lot of them. I have played all of them. I was thinking the other day, there are more than I had remembered, because there's Yoshi's Island, there's Yoshi's Story, there's Yoshi's Island 2 on DS, there's Yoshi's New Island on 3DS, there's Yoshi's Woolly World, and now Yoshi's Crafted World. I think that's all of them. So this is like this fifth or sixth. Which is a lot, but this one really feels like it's an iteration on what they've done, but it is also something new and exciting, and man, just as a technical showcase, it's really pretty jaw-dropping.
Awesome, yeah. For, like, thinking about, like, the way the aesthetic can work for you in a game, like, for me in Sekiro, the main thing that element accomplishes is the game has such a thick, palpable atmosphere, which I love so much. And it's something that, like, is where I think the From Software DNA feels the most strong here in Sekiro, is that sense of there's a real world that you live in, and they accomplish that feeling through like a lot of really subtle means and a lot of subtle elements of design. And so while they are not the most like technologically accomplished developers in the world, like the frame rate in Sekiro can be a little bit up and down in some places, like the textures are not the highest resolution textures you've ever seen on the PS4, that kind of stuff. The way that they design like environments, and particularly from like in both a macro sense and a micro sense, like just like the little details of like interiors and of characters and like things in the world that exist, that you see something and it like enters in the back of your mind, and then 5 hours later you encounter an item description or something that has an offhanded comment, and all of a sudden a light bulb lights up and you put two and two together and be like, oh my god, like that was that thing. That was that thing I saw 5 hours ago in that cave or whatever. That is what this like book is talking about, or that's what these like firecrackers come from, is from that thing. And those little elements that really sets from apart from everything else. Like that's the thing that, while I think Neo by Tecmo Koei is a really great one of those kinds of games and has a lot of really great action, and like the combat in that game is really advanced and really fascinating, that's the main thing where that game just can't compete, and I've never seen any other developer be able to design worlds in that way. Because then there's also just the way that the world feels completely interconnected, and with the exception of like a couple of special areas that you need to access through special means, which is true of all of those games, generally speaking, like 90% of the landmass of that game is one contiguous thing that you could run from, like the dilapidated temple where you start out. That's kind of your home base. You can start there. You can run from there to like any of the other areas in the game with like a handful of small exceptions, and just run without ever encountering a loading screen if you wanted to. And that's so rare for a game in this kind of genre, and that sense of you like wrapping back in on yourself and going back to old areas from new directions and seeing them from a new perspective that have been and has been populated by new characters and new enemies. Like if that's an element of Dark Souls that you really liked, like if that's one of the things that made Dark Souls 2 disappointing, as it did for me, is that Dark Souls 2 is one of the games that doesn't do a very good job at that. If that's something you really look for in these games, Sekiro has that in spades. But the other thing that Sekiro has that these games don't have, usually, that really adds to the atmosphere, is that it has a much more direct story that I found like oddly touching by the end. Like, it's not something that's like, you know, it's not a narrative heavy kind of game. There's not a big narrative focus. But the fact that you are playing as a like specific character, Okami, Wolf, or Sekiro, the title of the game is a like name he is given by another character at some point in the game, because it basically is like a pun that means one-armed wolf, because you lose your arm at the beginning of the game and have it replaced with that prosthetic they use for your special weapons. So Sekiro, the character you play as, is a specific character that has like a specific goal and an objective that he wants to achieve, and related to protecting Kudo, his lord. And he has voiced dialogue. In cutscenes, you have a couple of like dialogue options in different places and a couple of like specific choices, in a way that just feels very different for these kinds of games. And by the end of the game, I felt myself like actually really invested in Sekiro as a character. This like weird, terse, stoic shinobi guy that like seems to only really care about fulfilling his duty. Over the course of the story, you get a little bit more sense of like what he really wants and who he really is. And then like around him is a small, but I think actually legitimately interesting cast of characters, who all have, like, as with everything else in these games, like a tremendous sense of history to them. And so you're encountering characters like the Dr. Emma, who's the woman you go to like increase your like the amount of like healing items you can get and stuff like that. As you go through the game, you get to have different conversations with her, or the sculptor who made your prosthetic arm that gives you the different upgrades, or Kudo, or Ishin is another character you eventually meet, for people who play the game. That is like probably my favorite character in the game, because he's just very cool. And that sense of there being like a more approachable layer of narrative in one of these games is something I think a lot of people are maybe nervous about, because Dark Souls and From Software as a developer is very famous for the very obscure, kind of mysterious stories that force you to piece together lots of different elements to kind of understand what's going on. This is a much more sort of focused character story at its core, and has a lot of those more opaque elements around the edges, for you to piece together, but it's not necessary to be like a weird video game detective to find out what is ever anything is going on in the world in the way that it is in the other games that From Software has made. And I really actually enjoy the balance that this game strikes a lot. And It's something where there are multiple different endings to the game. There's a bad ending and then kind of three good endings, with the one I got, I think, is basically what people are considering to be the true ending. And it's actually something where I really hope they make a Sekiro 2 and like a direct narrative sequel that follows the specific ending I got, because it leaves this like room open for another story to tell in the future with these characters. That I would really love to see what they could do in the future in this setting with some of these characters and with this like sense of world building, where Sekiro has this really grounded historical world that has supernatural elements put on top of it, which makes me way more invested in the idea of seeing another game like this. In a way that, like, I would love to see a Bloodborne 2, because Bloodborne 1 is an amazing game, but I don't need a Bloodborne 2. I never needed Dark Souls 2 or Dark Souls 3, because those stories are so opaque and vague. That's like, there's not a lot to be like, oh, I really want to see what they would, like, what would happen in the story here. Like, I legitimately would really love to see them take another shot at, like, telling another story with these characters and in this setting and push the envelope forward to another level, because I was legitimately surprised constantly by how effective I found the storytelling in the game, even with how, like, sort of short and focused it was. It's very to the point, which is maybe something that works a lot for the setting where you have all these very, like, aristocratic, kind of stoic Japanese characters speaking very tersely and directly about whatever's going on. It fits the style they're going for, and it's one of the areas that I think Sekiro surprised me the most, because it just wasn't something that I would have ever looked for from this developer to do in their, one of their games. And now it's something I hope that, whether it's Sekiro 2 or if they go in a totally different direction, I'd love to see them continue in this direction of including more direct narratives on top of having the more obscure things around the edges.
Yoshi does not have a story worth talking about.
What does it have, like, an opening cutscene that gives you some vague
yes.
setup for what's going on?
Yeah.
What happens to the opening cutscene?
In this one, it is Yoshi's Island. It has, like, a big, like, spirit gem. It's called the Dream Gem. And it is actually five gems. So that might be, like, a translation thing. But there is a stone tablet that they have five gems in. And Baby Bowser and Kamek, the wizard, come in to steal the gems. And then the gems are scattered all over the island, and Yoshi has to go get the gems again. But there is a scene in a level I played today where you construct this little bus stop and then you wait for a bus. And while Yoshi is waiting for the bus, he sits down and whistles the theme of the game while he's sitting there, like, waving his little Yoshi legs. And then the bus comes, and I did tweet that out, and it is fucking delightful. So that is nice.
That is nice. That sounds very pleasant.
Yes. Yeah. So I think we've run out of comparisons between these two extraordinarily different games. Anything else to say about Sekiro, Sean?
It's just an amazing game. Like, I'm toying with the idea of I might just go ahead and, like, run straight through, like, with a new game plus. Which I'm sure I will start one, because I've done that with literally every single From Software game, other than Dark Souls 2, because I didn't like that one that much. But with Dark Souls 1, 3, and Bloodborne, I have always started a new game plus immediately, played through the first couple of areas in a couple of hours, and then kind of fallen off. With Sekiro, I think there's a better chance that I actually play all the way through and get another one of the endings. Because I know that there is a different last boss but there's another boss you can encounter if you go down one of the paths of the other endings that now I really want to fight. And I didn't realize that there was a way that I could have fought him and still got the ending that I got, but I didn't know that that was something you could do. So now I want to do that.
Nice. I will probably have more to say about Yoshi next week. I have not beaten it yet. It's only been out 72 hours. But I do want to close this episode, Sean. Thomas, my brother, who is living in Japan for a year, he sent me a text saying, here are two useless facts about Japan. So I thought I will share those useless facts, because he also says he wants to see if he can send me a new useless fact he has observed in his time there every week, and maybe this could become a fun podcast segment. So here are Thomas's two useless facts about Japan for this week. One, people learning English say maybe all the time. Too much. Advanced students say perhaps. I think it's because the Japanese word tabun is used in many more situations.
That makes sense. I can see that. Yeah. Yes.
Number two, this is the one that makes me laugh. Almost everyone here uses a multi-pen, those thick pens with three or more colors. Stores have large displays devoted to these kinds of pens. That is all in this installment of useless Japanese trivia.
I mean, if it's... I mean, a lot of people in America use those pens also. I feel like maybe he's underselling, like, the American...
I don't see, though, but... I don't know. I don't think I've seen one of those since I got to Iowa. I think they're in some places, but not others. Maybe that's true of Japan, but I don't know. He was telling me this on the phone, too. It made me laugh. It is a weird observation.
I'm glad that he's, learning some things of value or otherwise, and with his long journey to Japan, he'll come back with a lot of knowledge about the uses of multi-pins, the weird quirks about saying the word maybe when you're learning English from a Japanese perspective. A lot of interesting information.
Yes. We'll be back next week. I don't know how to transition out of that, but we'll be back next week. We'll talk about something. We're not sure what. Maybe it'll be Lord of the Rings. Maybe not. We'll find out.
SATs are coming up, not next week, but the week after next week. So maybe that'll be my lesson planning duties are decreased. So maybe that would be a good opportunity for me to watch the movie. I don't know.
Well, just let me know. We'll let our listeners know. And submit any ideas you have for Podcast 300. And we'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, and I think on that regard, Jonathan, there is something now. If we do end up doing the top 10 books, there's one I really need to read in preparation now that I know exists. I really need to just go to the store and pick up Chicken Soup for the Soul. The cat did what?